Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, March 10th, 2017. So I have been told this is our seventh study session on Vincent Woodard's The Delectable Negro, Human Consumption and Homoeroticism in U.S. Slave Culture. We're picking up on Chapter 5. This is Eating Nat Turner. I've been looking forward to this chapter for some time. The whole book has been enjoyable, but with everything about Nate Parker's film that just came out, and I think a lot of people have, you know, thoughts, ideas, interest in Nat Turner and his insurrection. So will be great. I think we'll be able to cover the entire chapter today. Without further ado, Vincent Woodard's The Delectable Negro, Context of White Supremacy. We're getting right to it. Audio segment number one.
Chapter 5, Eating Nat Turner. Most people do not readily associate Nat Turner, the heroic figure and slave insurrectionist, with the themes of auto-cannibalism, white male consumptive desires, or homoeroticism. These themes, however, strongly inform how Southampton, Virginia, whites punished Turner and treated his corpse after his public lynching. In the 19th century, the white press throughout the country reported that Turner had sold his body for dissection, and spent the money on ginger cakes. Many papers reported that Turner feasted on these sweet ginger cakes before his own execution. This was an erroneous assertion, as slaves did not own themselves and therefore had no agency to barter and trade in their own flesh. More than anything, this ginger cake story reflected the psychology of whites who needed to convince themselves that black men such as Turner somehow consented to and were complicit in their social consumption. This linking of consent to black self-consumption was a common idea that found its way into lynching ritual practices in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. In 1934, whites made Claude Neal, whom they lynched in Jackson County, Florida, eat his cut-off penis and testicles. James McGovern relates the details of the Neal lynching in Anatomy of a Lynching. After taking the nigger to the woods about 4 miles from Greenwood, they cut off his penis. He was made to eat it. Then they cut off his testicles and made him eat them and say he liked it. Making Neal eat his own sexual organs, as grotesque as this was only a byproduct of an even more disturbing reality of white hunger and power. The cutting off and forced eating of the penis was a reflection of white male oral fixations upon black male virility and black male as a sexual threat. In a different erotic scenario, the white men might have taken the black penis into their own mouths or anuses, but in the absence of such imaginative privacy, they use the black male body as a type of puppet through which they grope, grapple with, and ultimately subdue their hungers for black male flesh and sex. On the level of ritual, it is not enough to simply desire and want to consume Neil. The ritual is not complete until he eats the evidence of white desire, swallowing his debasement and degradation along with white hunger and erotic fascination. Many whites feared that Turner would literally rise up from the grave and rebone himself. This is how some have explained the gruesome cannibalization of Turner after his death. William Sidney Drury, a member of the Southampton community, documented in the Southampton Insurrection the exact methods of punishment and post-mortem abuse of Turner's body. According to Drury, after Turner was executed, his body was delivered to doctors who skinned it and made grease of the flesh. Mr. R. S. Barnum's father owned a money purse made of his hide. This desire to literally possess Turner's flesh and make use of his body calls to mind the homoerotics of the Neil scenario, with Turner's flesh serving as fetish and symbol of corporeal possession. The money purse made of Turner's skin and the grease made from his boiled-down flesh convey the limitless consumptive uses of the slave and the myriad ways in which the ruling class could satiate unspoken desires and tastes for Negro flesh. Blacks of the Southampton community further complicated this erotics of taste through accusations that whites ingested Turner's boiled-down flesh as a medical substance, as I discussed earlier. William Styron brought all of this suppressed homoerotic and consumptive history to the fore with the publication of The Confessions of Nat Turner. Styron's The Confessions and the debate that surrounded it clarified, like no movement before had, why black people have maintained a tight-lipped silence on the subject of homoeroticism under slavery. Homoeroticism, especially in the context of Turner's legacy, brought up for black people in the 1960s unspeakable issues of white consumption of blacks, sexual objectification, bestial treatment under a white regime, and the inconceivable topic of auto-cannibalism, blacks made to eat one another and themselves during slavery. The 1960s was a moment when the legacy of black consumption under slavery culminated round the activist platforms and ideologies of the civil rights and black power movements. The subjects of slavery, homosexuality, and cannibalism took front page prominence in newspapers and journals, editorials, speakouts, and mediated conversations between blacks and whites. In this chapter, I use the black radicals' 1960s to further illuminate the myriad social, spiritual, political, and moral implications of white hunger for and consumption of the black male during slavery. Issues of memory and temporality figure prominently in this chapter and drive my desire to understand the emotional and psychic forces that accrued around Turner's person, lending his life a mystic and transhistorical significance in the 1960s. Some of the black men who responded collectively to Styron's novel in the widely read William Styron's Nat Turner, 10 Black Writers Respond, accused Styron of institutionalized cannibalism, of attempting to eat Nat Turner. These black men refer to the legacy of white cannibalism that I discussed in earlier chapters. In this mid-20th century movement, characterized by political activism, black self-determination, and anti-apartheid efforts at home and abroad, black people powerfully linked individual and institutional consumption of the Negro to a negative understanding of homosexuality and effeminacy. The implicit homoerotics of flesh tasting and the particulars of white culinary appetite for black flesh congealed in this moment. One thing that was clarified through this union and in the context of national debate was why, during and beyond slavery, it has been so difficult for black people to talk openly about homoeroticism and, furthermore, to talk in complex ways about the linkages among black male gender formation, intimacy patterns originating in slavery, same-sex desire, and racial uplift. In this chapter, and through Turner's legacy, I broach the issue of why so little evidence and analysis of homoeroticism during slavery has survived. By referencing the antebellum cannibalism debate, discussions of resistance and revolt during slavery, and the charged pivotal 1960s, I ground this idea of homoerotic survival in political and social context. Because what this 1960s moment reveals, among its many startling revelations, is how homoeroticism in the context of Black experience has always been embedded in issues of Black nation formation, liberation, politics, and the legacy of literal and metaphoric Black consumption. In the second portion of the chapter, James Baldwin emerges as an important mediating figure and filter for my discussion of homoeroticism and Black cultural formation in the 1960s. As friend of Styron and nationally acknowledged Black activist and artist, Baldwin found himself in the uncomfortable position of speaking as a Black and homosexual person who understood the import of Blacks and whites breaking their historical silence concerning the homoerotic legacies of slavery. Rather than disavowing Styron's use of Turner's memory, Baldwin felt it necessary that white artists such as Styron be allowed to work through their fears of and fixations upon the Black revolutionary. Baldwin saw Styron confronting Black people with a disturbing but necessary vision of a shared racial history and feared that Black people would, out of their terror at the past and mistrust of white people, miss out on this historic opportunity to dialogue and confront the past. At base, Baldwin advocated for a model of Black homoeroticism that incorporated and transformed the trauma of the past. I resuscitate Baldwin's model and correlate it with the visions and racial uplift politics of the same time, Black male race leaders who denied and denigrated his person and vision. The Negro Homosexual Problem. W.E.B. Du Bois' powerful framing of the Negro problem has gone down in history as one of the most formative premises of the beginning of the 20th century. This question literally haunted the lives and social strivings of Black people in the 19th and 20th centuries. For it was emancipation, the acquisition of the vote, and the desire to own property and contribute as full member of society that made the Negro problematic. This was not a static problem. Rather, it was the outgrowth of cataclysmic dynamic social change. The Negro problem and the Negro's emergence into full protected citizen status were two sides of the same coin. Acknowledging the 20th century importance of this problem, I would like to propose a slight amendment to its scope. In the 1960s, a newer, more complicated version of this problematic emerged into the national scene. And that was the problem of homosexuality within Black experience. From the antebellum period on, this problem had percolated and boiled beneath Black family structures, racial liberation and uplift, and icons of male heroicism and valiance. In 1967, this bedrock gave way to the lava underneath, and what had long remained unspoken in the mainstream took on frightening voice and form. The occasion for this eruption was the publication of Styron's The Confessions. Styron described the novel in the author's note as a meditation on history. Styron took the title of the text directly from Thomas R. Gray's interview with Turner, The Confessions of Nat Turner, which Gray published after Turner was executed. The novel explores the specifics of Turner's upbringing and his relationship to his kinmen. Special attention is given to the topics of his parental lineage, his life on the plantation as a house slave, his early childhood interactions with and feelings toward his enslaved kinsmen, his acquisition of literacy, and his lifelong mission of enlightening his fellow men. It culminates, of course, with the Southampton insurrection. In keeping with the confessional format of the original Confessions, in the novel, Turner tells his story to a fictional Gray, a court-appointed attorney who visits him while he awaits execution and records all the minutiae of his life. Widely reviewed and well received, Styron's novel received the Pulitzer Prize in 1968 and was translated into at least 5 different languages, German, Spanish, and Italian among them. Even before its publication, the New American Library paid $100,000 for the paperback rights. The Book of the Month Club set a personal record by offering $150,000 for the novel. Styron could not have known that his novel would become a lightning rod for racial controversy. He was not the first, nor would he be the last, to revisit the memory of Turner in order to make sense of his life for a present generation. The publication of Styron's novel collided with a number of other historical forces to produce an explosive effect. Malcolm X was assassinated on February 21, 1965. On March 31, 1968, Lyndon Johnson announced that he would not run for re-election, 4 days after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. And approximately a month and a half later, Styron received the Pulitzer Prize for a novel that, in the minds of many, denigrated the memory of King and other black freedom fighters and revolutionaries. All of these historical occurrences set the stage for the Black Power era and marked a time of increased black militancy, which Turner's revolution legacy perfectly embodied. Unlike those who struggled during the 1940s and 50s, blacks at this moment in history grew more vocal about the connection between their radical efforts and historical recovery efforts, and were therefore not willing to allow Styron or any other white person to continue to appropriate and determine the meaning of their radical heroes from the past. In an essay review of the novel, Oliver Killens felt moved to correlate King's death with that of that other valiant freedom fighter, Nat Turner. Concerning Styron's depiction of Turner, he notes, "It reveals more about the psyche of the Southern liberal Styron, direct descendant of old Massa, than it even begins to reveal about the heart and soul and mind of black revolutionary Nat Turner." He goes on to correlate the popular reception of Styron's novel with the death of King. "Black brothers and sisters, be not deceived by the obscene weeping and gnashing of teeth by white America over the assassination of our great black brother and messiah, Martin Luther King. They loved him not, or he would still be here amongst us. They understood him not. Our Martin was a revolutionary, and they did not dig him. Therefore, they destroyed him." Black people felt themselves assailed from all sides, in the present moment by white racist institutions and ideologies, and in their memories of the past, which they felt that whites, like Styron, had stripped from them and distorted. Blacks felt that Styron had written his own white liberal Southern confession rather than anything that approached Turner's motivations, convictions, and interior struggles. To be fair, it was not entirely Styron's fault that the media and the conservative mainstream artistic community had lauded his novel and positioned him as an authentic scribe of Negro male psychology and historical experience. Had he not received so much attention and had been hailed as a true, insightful perceiver, his document and his historical methodology would have probably received little attention from black people. But his accolades mirrored too closely the violent racial reality of the 1960s. That same year, 1968, Columbia, the university that administered the Pulitzer, acted in a racially prejudiced manner towards the black Harlem community, moving to violently contain student civil disobedience efforts. In 1963, a white assassin had gunned down Medgar Evers, the field secretary for the NAACP, in his Mississippi carport. The Nation of Islam, with the rumored assistance of the U.S. Secret Service, had assassinated Malcolm X in 1965. That same year, a 6-day insurrection began in the Watts section of Los Angeles. Amid this national furor, Styron's novel and notoriety led to the resurrection of the most contentious and racially charged aspects of Turner's legacy. In November of 1968, Styron received a letter from one Robert B. Franklin in Elkhart, Indiana, describing how he had come to possess Turner's missing skull. "I have in my possession a skull," he begins, "which I believe to be that of Nat Turner. The skull was given to me by my father, who inherited it from his. My grandfather was a doctor who practiced in Richmond, Virginia, around the turn of the century. The skull was given to him by a female patient whose name is not known. She claimed to have gotten it from her father, who was a physician in attendance when Nat Turner was executed." Turner's missing skull had long been a sore spot for black people living in and outside of the Southampton, Virginia community. The beheading of Turner coincided with the boiling down of his flesh and the use of his skin parts to make the notorious money purse. Franklin's letter to Styron only confirmed long-standing black suspicions that whites had literally and socially consumed Turner's body. Whether or not Franklin actually possessed Turner's skull, a fact that remains today unproven by medical science, his safeguarding of the skull and treating it like a cherished family heirloom demonstrates that well into the late 20th century, the possession of Turner's cannibalized body had social and historical significance for whites. This issue of whites consuming Turner's body influenced late 19th and mid-20th century black resistance communities and their practices. The 19th century question of Turner's consumption reared its head in the 20th century in a way that redefined the issue of black consumption under slavery and lent an even greater import to the disappearance of Turner's body. In the 1960s, such concerns took on a political edge that is documented in the above-mentioned 10 Black Writers Respond. Apart from its critique of Styron's novel, 10 Black Writers Respond is a singular historical and cultural document that is a touchstone for the numerous debates that surrounded the novel. I intend to address Styron's novel shortly. Before analyzing the novel, though, I want to spend a bit of time on 10 Black Writers Respond, because the range of activists, scholarly and psychological perspectives contained therein provides a frame for my latter readings of homoeroticism and consumption during slavery. The individuals published in the 10 Black Writers Respond help us understand how time and memory altered the cannibalism debates that I present in earlier chapters, and they also clarify how a more contemporary language of consumption and same-sex eroticism evolved from slavery-era debates about cannibalism. The subject of cannibalism during slavery was difficult for black people to talk about in the 1960s. In some respects, even more difficult than it was for black people who lived through slavery. This difficulty had in part to do with Turner's dismemberment, his missing skull, and the coveted money purse made of his skin, and the fact that he never received a complete burial. Moreover, this torture and social consumption of Turner constituted an unresolved realm of racial trauma that black men had not yet begun to forthrightly address. In an essay from 10 Black Writers Respond, the failure of William Styron, Ernest Kaiser chastises Styron for writing an article that gives the explicit details about cooking and consuming Turner's flesh. Examples of bestial descriptions in his article, writes Kaiser, are his unnecessary, gruesome explanation that the doctor skinned Nat Turner's dead body after he was hanged along with 17 other Negroes and made grease of his flesh, and the lurid details in his novel of the killings of whites by Negroes. Kaiser spoke for most of the black men in the edited collection who simply could not bear such descriptions of Turner, which they claim violated Turner in body as well as in cherished memory. In a moving letter to Harriet Tubman in 1868, Frederick Douglass described a domain of African-American memory reserved only for the most hallowed, self-sacrificing revolutionaries. He writes, "Excepting John Brown of sacred memory, I know of no one who has willingly encountered more perils and hardships to serve our enslaved people than you have. Much that you have done would seem improbable to those who do not know you as I know you. For Douglas, what makes John Brown sacred is his commitment, his sacrifice, and his willingness to die for black liberty. In his 1907 biography on Douglas, Booker T. Washington also invoked this idea of sacred memory, seeing in Douglas the noble embodiment of all black struggles during slavery. The life of Frederick Douglass is the history of American slavery epitomized in a single human experience. He saw it all, lived it all, and overcame it all. In Douglass, Washington saw what was greatest in the race as well as the potential for a high destiny. It was this spirit of commitment to the sacred memory of Turner that inspired the distinguished activist slash scholar John Henry Clark to compile and edit 10 Black Writers Respond. The idea was to hold persons such as Brown and Turner in their best light, to emphasize the aspects of their lives that could inspire and ennoble future generations. In his introduction to the collection, Clark emphasizes the connection between the sacred memory of Turner and the political climate of the 1960s. The contributors to this book collectively maintain that the distortion of the true character of Nat Turner was deliberate. The motive for this distortion could be William Styron's reaction to the racial climate that has prevailed in the United States in the last 15 years. Clark goes on to position H. Rapp Brown and Stokely Carmichael, two black power proponents, as direct descendants of Turner's legacy. Some of the titles of the essays compiled in the anthology reveal the feelings of the sacred and personal ownership black men associated with Turner's memory. Vincent Harding's You've Taken My Nat and Gone, Lerone Bennett Jr.'s Nat's Last White Man, and Charles V. Hamilton's R. Nat Turner and William Styron's Creation are examples. The image of Turner as consumed by whites did not fit into this model of the sacred black heroic figure. In his analysis cited earlier, Kaiser links the cannibalization of Turner to emasculation, effeminacy, and larger moral issues confronting the nation. He points out how Styron's argument builds upon the fraudulent and untenable thesis of Frank Tenenbaum and Stanley M. Elkins, which was that American slavery was so oppressive, despotic, and emasculating psychologically that revolt was impossible and Negroes could only be Sambos. Styron has admitted in an interview that the text that most influences thinking about slavery as an institution and that the slave psychology was Elkin's slavery. Kaiser briefly entertains the issue of cannibalism in the white author's writing only to point out how lurid, bestial, and morally wrong are Styron's perspectives. Kaiser's remarks reveal how black people repressed and did not discuss certain painful issues, such as this issue of human consumption. It was painful for blacks and strategically risky to publicly broach subjects that might add fuel to white misconceptions and attempt to emasculate black men in the past and the present. Only 20 years earlier, ethnologist Melville J. Herskovitz had published The Myth of the Negro Past as a way of refuting strongly held beliefs that the Negro had no cultural legacy, came from a land of heathens and cannibals, and benefited from his bondage in America. Styron's novel proved that for many whites, all of the revised black history and documented anthropological proof in the world could not dissuade them from the idea that the African was innately ignorant and destined to subservience to the white male. Kaiser paraphrases Gertrude Wilson of the New York Amsterdam News, who explained the connections between Styron's confessions and contemporary racial apartheid in the following manner. The book is so popular with whites because it proves that if Negroes retaliate against injustice by violence, they will be quelled by violence. The book also gives, she says, the blessings of history for continued violence against Negroes. The rampant church bombings, lynchings, and assassinations of the 1960s supported Wilson's assertions. Styron's novel only exacerbated the myths and social fictions that fueled this institutionalized violence against African-American persons. Equating black consumption with homosexuality. Kaiser's unwillingness to talk about the topic of cannibalism did not make it any less relevant to or have less of an impact on all of the 10 black men who responded to Styron's novel. In fact, what happened as a result of the compounded pain of the past and the threat of social consumption and racial annihilation in the present was that black men approached discussions of Styron's novel in order to liberate the voice of the people and at the same time reinforce historical silences. Their general approach tended to diminish the emotional aspects of their masculinity, foregrounding a negative image of homosexuality, and left the issues of white consumption and black self-consumption to fester in the black imagination and soul. The 10 black male contributors coupled cannibalism, overtly and covertly, with homoeroticism and effeminacy. For these black men, homoeroticism became a way of circumventing and projecting their experiences and pain onto a certain effeminate black man. The consumed black man these black men equated with the homosexual man. Homosexuality served as a means of containing certain unwieldy and historically difficult topics pertaining to black masculinity, such as the need for intimacy, gender variance, sexual and emotional vulnerability, and violation. It was as if, in this very powerful and discursive moment, threads that had been all along winding through history wove together in a manner that illuminated the past as much as they clouded and blocked full access to its complicated meaning. Vincent Harding, in distinction from the other 9 authors, foregrounds a connection between the consumption of Turner and the contemporary consumption of black men. Rather than chastising Styron for speaking about Turner's cannibalization, as does Kaiser, Harding openly accuses Styron of attempting to cannibalize Nat Turner. Now, this is precisely what William Styron fails to do with the world and words of Nat Turner. He has been unable to eat and digest the blackness, the fierce religious conviction, the power of the man. Harding draws upon the antebellum legacy of the black heroic figure as impermeable, steeled, and inviolate to prove his point. It is Turner's power and driveness, his liberating truth, that makes him impervious to the jaws and appetites of whites, those who have neither eaten nor mourned. Harding writes the truth. Styron's Turner appealed to the general media, to highbrow white literate communities, and to institutions that awarded and sanctioned literary greatness. Styron's Turner appealed to white desires for a palatable black radical figure diminished in all of his complexity and transhistorical powers. Harding's thinking about black male consumption reflected traditional models of black male virility, literacy, and enlightened consciousness. The counterpoint to the virile, powerful figure in Harding's essay, and in most of the essays the other black men wrote, was the effeminate, homosexual, and therefore emasculated black man, where radical individuals such as Turner, Martin Luther King Jr., and George Jackson could not be eaten. The assumption was that a Luke, a raped black man depicted in the Harriet Jacobs slave narrative, a James L. Smith, or a contemporary James Baldwin could be consumed. Harding's discussion of homosexuality in the novel begins with Brantley, a social outcast among whites, and a personal repulsive homosexual whose speciality seems to be the molesting of young boys. Brantley is, in Harding's view, the typical white male parasite of the parasitic master/slave relation. It is disturbing to Harding that Styron alone chose to create such a pariah-like personality for the one white man who is drawn to Nat Turner's religious teachings. This is a perfect example of Styron's attempt to make palatable the fierce religious conviction of the heroic black figure. Styron's use of homosexuality and Christian-sanctioned incest to turn Turner into a consumable subject. In the previous chapter, I discuss how there is an undercurrent of historical truth to this dynamic between black and white men during slavery. It would have been, of course, inappropriate for Harding, in his defensive posture, to invoke this history. It would have only added grist to the white mill of consumption he was attempting to deconstruct. Still, his easy conflation of homosexuality with consumption of black male virility and power with immunity to consumption perpetuates silences in unspeakable domains of black male experience extending back to slavery. I intend to discuss these more thoroughly, but for the moment, let us explore more deeply how other black writers in Clark's compilation perpetuate Harding's correlation of homosexuality, emasculinization, and sexual taint. Loyal Hairston's also equated emasculation with homosexuality. William Styron, writes Hairston, triumphantly reduces his slave to a religious celibate, a kind of self-castration. Poor Nat Turner's only sexual experience is, alas, a homosexual. Lerone Bennett Jr. accuses Styron of emasculating Nat Turner by depicting him as an impotent, sex-crazed celibate who masturbates every Saturday in the carpenter's shop, and as one who has a homosexual encounter in a detailed white fantasy life. Concurring with Bennett, psychologist Alvin F. Poussin offers further insights into Styron's psychological motivations. I think Styron's selection of factual and psychological material speaks for itself. It speaks for itself again when we read that the closest our black rebel comes to a realized sexual experience is through a homosexual one with another young black slave. What is the communication here? Naturally, it implies that Nat Turner was not a man at all. It suggests that he was unconsciously really feminine. From these and other observations, there emerges a complicated picture of homosexuality as understood in this context. We could begin with just the use of the word homosexual. Most black men in the collection used the word homosexual, which had no currency during the antebellum period, to describe Styron's Turner. While Styron himself does not actually use that word in his novel, the use of the word speaks to a conflation of historical time periods, the conflation of 20th century psychological discourses of sexual deviancy with same-sex behavior in all of its variations, in the context of slavery. On the one hand, the use of the word homosexual conveys a lack of historical consciousness and a historical specificity on the part of the black men. On the other hand, this word, as a reflection of the 1960s racial politics, does accurately convey how the legacy of slavery fed into contemporary understandings of homosexuality in the context of black experience. In the minds of many of these men, the state was a virile, predatory white man that had long preyed upon and sought to instill in black men an effeminate sexual availability. Late 20th century scholars of sexuality, responding to the use of the words homosexual, faggot, and effeminate by the black male writers, have tended to refer to the group as homophobic or as maintaining homophobic assumptions. This easy conflation of the past with present, of an effeminate man during slavery with a homosexual man in the present, reflects the extent to which this historical era marked yet another recalibration of the meaning and application of the history of slavery. Ron Ireman writes in Cultural Trauma, Slavery and the Formation of African American Identity, that every 20 to 30 years, individuals look back and reconstruct a traumatic past. One could plot the publication of Styron's novel, the assassinations of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr., and the publication of Ten Black Writers Respond on a 20-year cycle dating from the Emancipation Proclamation. The year 1965 marks the fifth 20-year cycle following the end of slavery, or the 100-year anniversary of emancipation. At stake for so many black people were not just the historical facts of experience, but also the power to control and interpret the meaning and historical significance of the legacy of slavery. Poussin and others make extensive references to historical texts about slavery written by white men. Herbert Aptheker's American Negro Slave Revolts was an exemplary text for this ample depiction of the spirit and practice of revolt that pervaded slave life. Many black persons consider Thomas A. Bailey's The American Pageant, A History of the Republic, a prejudicial text that infantilized and diminished Turner's contributions. Most of the 10 black men considered Stanley M. Elkins' Slavery, a text that directly informs Styron's portrait of Turner, to be a strongly white-influenced text, even though Elkins was African-American. More than anything, black men and women felt strongly compelled to protect the image of the black family, black masculinity, and black motherhood and womanhood as sustained in the context of slavery. Within this recreated and imagined context, there was no room for a complicated understanding of homoeroticism during slavery. In her critique of Styron's novel, Alice Walker emphasized how Styron depicted Turner as loving a white woman and how he uses homosexuality to strip Turner of his revolutionary spirit and power. A slave revolutionary who revolts simply because he cannot have the woman he loves, if he loves her, and there is no proof that Nat loved anybody white, denies that there was anything about slavery itself to make him revolt. Revolts are made, but rarely from the love of one adolescent enemy female whom one lovingly stabs and then beats over the head with a fence post until she's dead. Besides, if Nat were really a homosexual, as Mr. Styron implies, why should he bother? June Meyer, better known as June Jordan, interpreted the confessions as an attack on Turner's masculinity and that of black men in general. In her 1967 review, published in The Nation, she wrote, "There is a man who exists as one of the most popular objects of leadership and legislation and quasi-literature in the history of all men. There lives a man who is spoken for, imagined, feared, and criticized, pitied, misrepresented, fought against, reviled, and loved, primarily on the basis of second-hand information, or worse." Meyer's review speaks to the long-standing systematic use and consumption of the black male. Meyer critiques both Styron and those who favorably reviewed his novel for taking Turner out of context, depicting him as disconnected from black family and community. The black women and men who reviewed the confessions overtly and covertly assumed a relationship between the black family during slavery and black male virility. Sex and gender, they also conflated with homosexuality, made out to equal effeminacy. Many blacks linked homosexuality to castration and the recent history of black men who had been lynched and black women who had been raped in the Jim Crow South and in the North. Homosexuality, in its metaphoric power, had an exhaustive function. It is equated with the absence of family, hatred of black people, estrangement from one's kin and culture, and all of those horrific aspects of black experience about which black people would rather not speak. On the surface, at least, I do not disagree with these black men and women. I think their analysis regarding historicity and the diminishment of black communal ties was mostly correct. Styron's novel was historically inaccurate, depicting Turner as raised by whites rather than the black parents and grandmother Turner spoke about in his original Confessions. Styron depicts aspects of Turner's sexual life that are not validated in any documentation coming from the time period, and Styron's exhaustive probing into the racial hatred and self-hatred of Turner clearly reflected something in his own psyche and white identity that he felt compelled to project onto Turner. Black men were put on the defensive by both the novel and by the institutions, literary production, the media, and individuals who supported Styron as an authentic interpreter of black historical experience. Many black men, like Bennett, felt that Styron was waging a literary war that paralleled the contemporary political and police state war against black men. He wages literary war on this Nat Turner's image, substituting an impotent, cowardly, irresolute creature of his own imagination for the real black man who killed or ordered killed real white people for real historical reasons. In such embattled situations, black people have had to historically adopt strategic postures. They have had to adopt a perspective of themselves, the race, and their history that white people could not eat and digest. That was the irony of this moment. Black people invoked the cannibal discourse that could have freed up and complicated black male perspectives on everything from social consumption to homoeroticism, only to defend black masculinity and black culture. Black men were not interested in, nor capable of dealing with, the complex legacy of cannibalism and homoeroticism that so powerfully shaped their responses to Styron's novel. One black man did have a fairly clear and nuanced understanding of the danger and potential of this moment, James Baldwin. Indeed, Baldwin predicted that Styron's novel would be a storm center. In an interview for Newsweek, he acknowledged, "It'll be called effrontery. Bill's going to catch it from black and white. It's a very courageous book that attempts to fuse the two points of view of the masters and the slaves. It's important for the black reader to see what Bill is trying to do and recognize its validity." In preparation for his novel, Styron read Baldwin's writings and spoke extensively with the black author about black experience. Styron credited Baldwin with breaking down his greatest racial prejudices. "Jimmy broke down the last shred of whatever final hang-up of Southern prejudice I might have had, which was trying to tell me that a Negro was never really intelligent." Baldwin encouraged Styron, which might partially explain why he was not invited to contribute to 10 Black Men Respond. Generally speaking, black people felt confused by and disapproved of Baldwin's support of Styron. As part of his response to Styron, Harding also critiqued Baldwin. Harding's comments to Baldwin began to broach an area that was largely unexplored in the national debate, and that is the feelings, emotions, secrets, and common history that Styron's novel brought up for black men in relation to one another. Harding, in so many words, refers to Baldwin as a race betrayer. "Nevertheless, as with all tragedy, the deepest level is to be found within us, black us. And it was perhaps symbolized by one of our most important artists, James Baldwin. For it was Baldwin who praised his friend's work highly, Baldwin who saw himself in Styron's Turner, and Baldwin who dared to say, 'This is the beginning of our common history.'" In the Newsweek interview, Baldwin actually refers to Styron as constructing our common history. Harding strongly disagreed with this statement. "Surely, it's nothing of the kind. In spite of Baldwin's largest, kindest hopes, Styron has done nothing less and nothing more than create another chapter in our long and common agony. He has done it because we have allowed it, and we who are black must be men enough to admit that bit of fact. There can be no common history until we have first fleshed out the lineaments of our own, for no one else can speak out of the bittersweet bowels of our blackness. The fact is that Baldwin, in a most ironic and painful way, was right. Styron, I think, rather unconsciously, wrote out of a shared historical consciousness of slavery, and part of the disavowal and swearing off of this tie by Harding and other black men had to do with black men being neither ready nor able to face the painful legacy of objectification, incest, infantilization between master, patriarch, and slave. Black men were not ready to look at how their institutional consumption in the 1960s originated in slavery old processes of cannibalization. So many powerful unexamined emotions, such as hatred, love, desire, and need, undergirded the historical relationship between black men and white men.
Context of White Supremacy. That is our first audio segment. Vincent Harding, The Delectable Negro, Human Consumption and Homoeroticism in U.S. Slave Culture. If you have commentary you would like to share, the number to dial 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you don't want to use your phone, you can use the free VOPE line. It's linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tiny.cc/oneRace. That is the number one. Address again, tiny.cc/oneRace. And that is the number one. When you put in the address, click the link on the left of the page. It says free VOPE line. When you click it, it will open a small window on your screen, top line. When you see that window, it has three lines. The top line, it's a drop-down menu. Select the number I just gave, which again is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can put in a real name, nickname, you can press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. After you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the program. It is the same procedure. If you would like to participate, you will see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6. When you do so, you will hear an audio prompt. Press the number 1 and we will get you on the line. All the folks who dialed in who have a hand up, who have commentary to share, feel free. Your line should be open.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir, Mr. Demery Ford. Oh, if you want to give your emailed update, my apologies. If you want to give your email commentary about the, I think it's candelabra from last week, the white racist slave master who stole it from the slave. You want to share that with listeners? That would be great too.
Oh yes, commenting on that candle holder, it brought up some interesting thoughts. I thought about it and I did a little research on it. That type of silver candle holder, it would have been mostly pure silver, And so as a family heirloom today, that a particular candle holder could bring as much as $75,000. So it was, insult to injury that they were practicing racism on Aunt Marthy even after on into infinitum, because it was passed down through the family. But on to the reading today. When it began, it started with an article in the Norfolk Herald talking about Turner had sold his body for dissection and spent the money on ginger cakes. Many papers reported that Turner's feasted on these sweet ginger cakes before his own execution. And there's a footnote, number two, for the back on where he got it from. And it goes on to show that this is erroneous assertion that slaves did not own themselves and therefore had no agency to barter and trade for their own flesh. So it just goes to show that these white people practicing racism even after the man's death and lying at it. And I thought it was interesting that the author would use William Sidney Dewey, a member of the Southampton community, a racist suspect, writing in the Southampton insurrection, and William Styron, another racist suspect, both born in the South, and Styron probably from a wealthy family that probably owned slaves. And just like some of the comments later on concerning his work, The Confession of Nat Turner, which was, by the way, fiction, but probably based a lot on facts. But how much of it, we don't know, and how much he turned around. Well, we have to think about the time that it was published, too, because it was doing turmoil, racial turmoil. Maggie Evers was shot. Malcolm X was assassinated. Dr. Martin Luther King. And the riots, and even at this time, you know, he going to release a book like this to excite, you know, a storm of criticism from blacks. And I'm in a agreement that, you know, that was an act of racism. And also, last but not least, I was in agreement with, I think it was Gertrude Wilson, you know, of the New York Amsterdam, would explain the connection between Styron's confession and contemporary racial apartheid in this following manner. The book is so popular with whites because it proved if Negroes retaliate against injustice by violence, they will be quelled by violence. The book also gives, she says, the blessing of history for continued violence against Negroes. And I think that was the reason for the book, and I think that's the reason for all these antebellum programs that's coming up now, and all this whole movement is to hold back any so-called Negro uplift, which I guess is the ideology of William E.B. Du Bois about the more educated of the race responsible for the less educated. But I'll mute my line on that, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Absolutely. Other folks who have commentary, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus. Greetings to you, Mr. Devery, for and to the other callers and the listeners. I'll start with what Mr. Demery Ford ended with in regards to him speaking about the reasons for Styron's novel and the fact that it exacerbated myths and social functions that fueled institutionalized violence against African-American persons. I just think that just goes to show what the power of a written text can have. And I mean, whether it's that work or any other work that propagates the ideology of racial genocide and terrorism against black people, but just for him to highlight that, I think is a very powerful thing, because I don't think a lot of us tend to think about books in that context in regards to the power of a work to trigger off societal shifts towards violence against black people. Just no different than like Mein Kampf by Hitler or some other text, where these works have a psychological effect on white people that push them in the direction of doing things that media now does as well, and entertainment. So I just wanted to highlight that. I just found this reading quite fascinating, especially in the beginning of the book, where Mr. Woodard writes, he says, most people do not readily associate Nat Turner, the heroic figure and slave insurrectionist, with the themes of auto-cannibalism, self-consumption, white male consumptive desires, or homoeroticism. These themes, however, strongly informed how Southampton, Virginia, whites punished Turner and treated his corpse after his public lynching. In the 19th century, the white press throughout the country reported that Turner had, quote-unquote, sold his body for dissection and spent the money on ginger cakes. Many papers reported that Turner, quote, feasted on, unquote, these sweet ginger cakes before his own execution. This was an erroneous assertion that slaves did not own themselves and therefore had no agency to barter and trade their own flesh. More than anything, this ginger cake story reflected the psychology of whites who needed to convince themselves that black men such as Turner somehow consented to and were complicit in their social consumption. This linking of consent to black self-consumption was a common idea that found its way into lynching ritual practices in the late 19th century and early 20th centuries. In 1934, whites made Claude Neal, whom they lynched in Jackson County, Florida, eat his cut off penis and testicles. James McGovern relates the details of the Neal lynching in Anatomy of a Lynching. Quote, after taking the nigger to the woods about 4 miles from Greenwood, they cut off his penis and he was made to eat it. They then cut off his testicles and made him eat them and say that he liked it. Making Neal cut off his own sexual organs, as grotesque as this was only a byproduct of an even more disturbing reality of white hunger and power. The cutting off and forced eating of the penis was a reflection of white male oral fixations upon black male virility and black men as a sexual threat. In a different erotic scenario, white men might have taken the black penis into their own mouths or anuses, but in absence of such imaginative privacy, they used the black male body as a type of puppet through which they grapple with and ultimately subdue their hungers for black male flesh and sex. On the level of ritual, it is not enough to simply desire and want to consume Neal. The ritual is not complete until he eats the evidence of white desire, swallowing his debasement and degradation along with white hunger and erotic fascination. Man, this just really, pinpoints the myriad ways that consumption can work and how just the whole idea of white people voyeuristically partaking of this ritualized auto-cannibalism that they forced Neal to perform on himself was a puppetized version of themselves. And the erotic fascination and pleasure and satisfaction they got from just watching him do those things, due to him being forced by, of course, the threat of death and terror by these white people, just really shows how psychotic they really are. And I don't think a lot of us really, really understand, just because we've been acculturated and conditioned to live amongst them so long, and a lot of the things that they do, they don't really put a lot of it on the news. So essentially, it's more information about us and the things that they propagate about us in regards to their propaganda versus the actual facts of what they really do. And I think because of that, it's really hard for a lot of us to think about them in the way that this text is bringing out, as far as their psychopathology and the fact that none of this stuff that's being described in this text has stopped. Thus, a movie like Get Out doing and having the impact that it's having, because these things are really happening. They haven't stopped happening. They're actually just getting better refinement in today's day and age, but they're actually happening. And I just find that to be quite fascinating about their psychopathology, and it's something that we should really think about quite heavily in regards to our dealings with white people and just understanding them. He also writes, Franklin's, or this is on page 177, he writes, Franklin's letter to Styron only confirmed longstanding black suspicions that whites had literally and socially consumed Turner's body. Whether or not Franklin actually possessed Turner's skull, a fact that remains today unproven by medical science, his safeguarding of the skull and treating it as a cherished family heirloom demonstrates well into the late 20th century the possession of Turner's cannibalized body had social and historic significance for whites. And this also, just the history of them taking trophies and either eating them, partaking of them themselves, or saving them and passing them along in multiple generations of their family, made me remember last summer the white guy who, after the African American Museum was open in the Smithsonian, he had met with the family of Nat Turner there and said that he had a skull that he believed belonged to him based on his family history in regards to this being passed along. And he said it was given to him by his father. I guess they might still be waiting for the genetic testing to be completed, but at the time they said that they were going to have it tested to see if that was actually his skull. I haven't heard anything about the results. I'm going to try and do some research on that and see what I can come up with. But ultimately, like, that was a living example there of what's written in this text. And I'm wondering if that guy is actually connected to the people that I just read that he wrote about, simply because it just really helps to bring home the fact that we are something that is, we're objects of worship. It's just a twisted, sick, psychosexual, terroristic form of worship, but it's still a form of worship nonetheless. And we just have a lot to think about in regards to the people we're dealing with. And I'll give someone else a chance to speak, and I'll mute my line. I have a couple other things, but I'll give someone else a chance to speak. Thank you.
Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have a hand up and we haven't heard from you, you have comments you would like to share, feel free. Other folks with us that we have not heard from?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to the callers. just a few brief observations. I think the two gentlemen brought about the opinion of Stryden's novel being written for basically white people to attack, you know, Negroes during that time because of the fact that they were inhuman and, you know, whatever. But literature, like the gentleman had said before, is very important in regards to white supremacy action. You know, I thought about the Turner Diaries and Timothy McVeigh and how he was a big fan of the Turner Diaries, which prompted him to, you know, blow up a federal building in Oklahoma City. But, you know, these white supremacist novels, you know, are still being written today. You know, they have a novel called Victoria, novel of the Fourth Generation War. And then there's the Camp of Saints, which Steve Bannon often refers to. So white supremacist attack literature is still, you know, going on to this day. And in regards to using homosexuality as a way to effeminize strong black men, you know, I also thought about the book that was written by Manny Marable, which about Malcolm X, which, you know, I'm still kind of questioning if that was literally Marable's work, but you know, that was one of the attacks on Malcolm X's manhood, from the people that I know that read the book, it was only like a few words about a possible connection of him being homosexual. But, you know, I'm not going to get into that. But it's one of the things that, you know, it's still going on today and will probably continue. That was all I have. I'm in my line.
Appreciate that. If we have other folks with us that we have not heard from, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, everybody. Quick question, guys. The person that wrote the book, was that a white person or a non-white person?
Well, Vincent...
Not this...
Oh, which book are you talking about?
The book that they were talking about within this section of the reading.
William Styron is a white man. Confessions, book that, yeah, he's a white man, William Styron.
Okay, I just wanted to confirm before I speak any further. And I know it's, pardon me, excuse me for that. It's very interesting how these books come out, and I don't mean Delectable Negro, I mean the books that white people write about black people talking about racism or something like that. It's always during very pivotal moments or the book will do well because black people are agitated. And I would think the same thing is true for The Blood of Emmett Till. And I just, when I heard that, I was like, wow, that's fascinating. I mean, there are many, many levels to the consumption, even like at that level, to use literature as a way to create a name for yourself. And I feel that way every time someone says Martin Luther King Jr. had a dream. I just feel like it's necrophilic consumption because it's not evoking with any kind of real understanding or desire to do anything about non-white people's circumstances. Like, gay people are using it, white women are using it, like everybody around the world is using him. And I feel that way. To tie in with Nat Turner, I feel that way too. That people just feed, and it doesn't matter. People feed on us all the time. And I really don't know exactly what to say about the Turner piece, the specific parts about Turner, except that there was a lot I didn't even know. I mean, I don't even know. That means that there would have had to been a science for skinning people and creating oil. That's not something that you would just be like, oh, that's what we're going to do. Like, that must have been happening often. And then, I mean, that's just fascinating. And then, like, it was within the area, all the black people just having, like, a knowing that Nat Turner never got a proper burial, that his body was consumed in various ways. And I can see why so many black people never wanted to talk about in the formal enslavement period. It was like, okay, emancipation, moving forward, we don't want to talk about it, because each person would have some type of grotesque recollection that they would pass on. And so we're victims, just traumatized victims generationally. And another thought that occurred to me in listening to this reading is that, I know it's been stated before, so I'll just state it again, that in order to say, I don't think that they consumed Nat Turner because they hated Nat Turner. I don't think that at all. I feel that, and I don't even feel like, of course it's debasing, degrading, like most horrible forms of disrespect, but I feel like they, like you want something. So you consume it because you think it's powerful or great or medicinal, or I hope you all are understanding what I'm trying to say. Like, it's not like, oh, that whatever, he's nothing and we're going to make a purse out of him and consume his oil. I think it's like a really psychopathic kind of like reverence kind of thing. Because he did an amazing thing that white people did not think that black people would ever do, or never thought that one would do, to the extent that he did it and the way that he did it. But I don't know, that's just like a thought right now, that these white people, like, I really don't have words for it, because it's like, you can tell that you obviously have something, because if you didn't have nothing, they wouldn't want to consume it. Just like if we weren't powerful and couldn't overthrow the system, there wouldn't be so much surveillance and so much energy put into making sure that we never can think clearly or see clearly or understand anything. If we were so weak and weren't about nothing, then why? But that's it for now. Thank you.
All We have about 20 minutes before we get to the second audio segment. So if you have other comments, if we have listeners who have not shared additional things that you want to make sure that you offer before we get to the second audio segment, do not wait till the last minute. Make sure you get your hand up. Some of the things that stood out for me, the opening segment about James Claude Neal, Claude Neal, the black male who was lynched, mutilated in Florida. I read that segment, I think, a month ago when we were doing this, because this scene is described where he's castrated and then he has to eat his own genitalia. It's described in Isabel Wilkerson's The Warmth of Other Suns and probably many other texts, but I'd read that before, and we covered that on The Cows previously. I thought it was great. I think Roz and Mr. Demery touched on the kind of analysis of this, kind of metaphysical breakdown, psychoanalytic breakdown, excuse me, of this paragraph, which I thought you all covered it brilliantly. Continuing, where he talks about, this seemed to be a major theme for me in this chapter, his assertion that I'm reading from page 170, the bottom of 172, homoeroticism, especially in the context of Turner's legacy brought up for black people in the 1960s, unspeakable issues of white consumption of blacks, sexual objectification, bestial treatment under a white regime, and the inconceivable topic of auto-cannibalism. It seemed as though I felt like it was almost Cleo Monago was on the program. Mr. Monago is a black male. He's been on The Cows repeatedly. He even did a broadcast with Mr. Fuller. He admits publicly to being same gender loving, I think is the way that he phrases it. He does not use the term homosexual for reasons he explained on the program. But it sounded like him, where he says all the time, his line is, you cannot have a rational conversation with black people about this issue. Some of the language very much reminded me of the way that he talked about particularly black people in the 1960s. Like, you just can't have a rational conversation, that they're just not able to handle these issues. It's too painful for them to even, you know, conceive of or touch on. I do not accept that, any aspect of that rhetoric. I don't accept it now when people say something that I deem to be very similar about black people now, and I reject it within the context of this book. Continuing, when he says, he continues, and he leaves out, when he spoke last week, when he was reviewing Harriet Jacobs' Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, and saying that this is one of the few books that does include the sexual violation of black males on the plantation, Luke, and also the overall lack of references in terms of white slave masters raping, sexually violating black females during slavery, that this is not discussed at all. I think a huge part of that is not because black people are afraid or too much in pain or just not able to accept, or they're homophobic, or they're just not able to process and talk about and accept that these things happen. I think a huge aspect of that is that white people control what's going to be talked about. And if for whatever reason whites say that we're not going to talk about this because I just didn't know anything about it, it wasn't that I was afraid of talking about any of these things. It was too painful. I just didn't know about this until later. And I think for a lot of black people, they just didn't have that information. That is because of white people. Black people have been punished, killed, imprisoned, beaten, threatened for talking about racism and talking about in detail what has been done to us, with, you know, all kinds of threats against us. So, I mean, even if black people are not talking about these things, it would be whites that are most to blame. And at least to me, this chapter very much took the tone, in my view, of kind of castigating black people, that many of them, or most of them, passed away. I know Vincent Harding, he just passed away in 2014, same year as Dr. Maya Angelou. But that's the way that it came across to me, is kind of castigating black people and black males specifically as being homophobic in their treatment of James Baldwin, maybe even in their reading of William Styron's work and in their ability to think about homosexual activity, same gender loving, whether it's Plantation Times or elsewhere. That's the kind of tone that the whole chapter took. I don't know if that has to do with the author's possible engagement in this sexual activity or the editors of the book, since this book did was published posthumously. Let's see. I thought I'll go in order. I'll pick out things in order. Let's see. Where he says, Baldwin found himself in the uncomfortable position of speaking as a black homosexual person who understood the import of blacks and whites breaking their historical silence concerning the homoerotic legacies of slavery. Just that sentence right there. And this happens a lot. In my view, it is not historically accurate. If we're talking about black males and white males, that is not quote-unquote homoerotic action, a homoerotic legacy, a homoerotic relationship. That is still under the context of racism, white power, the era of plantation slavery. So any relationship, any sexual activity, this is not I just wrote about this with Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. These are not relationships. I wouldn't care if it is a white male and a black male. And I would not, to me, I see no reason to sidetrack or to make a big to-do and saying, oh, this was, homoerotic activity. Fine, we can accept that, but this is not, oh, well, now we need to rethink in terms of our sexual behavior and rethink my norms or values around sexual behavior, or even thinking if the black male enjoyed it because that came up before, or if he had leanings in this way anyway. All of that totally diverts from the main issue, which is white power, white terrorism, and white people sexually exploiting black people, period. I would not look, or I do not look at Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings and say, oh, I need to rethink male-female relationships. No, this is rape, period. That's how I'm thinking about this. So all of that to me, it just does not make sense at all. And to me, this is either racist influence or racist concepts that contaminate the way that we process events in racism, white supremacy. Next, where I just thought it was interesting the amount of time that William Styron's text commanded in this section. There is a lot of literature on Nat Turner, and more coming, probably, to have this white guy's controversial text. Yes, we talked about it before on the program, as have many folks. I have talked about this book, which was published more than 50 years ago, almost 60 years ago now, has been talked about regularly. That in and of itself stood out as being conspicuous to me, and particularly presenting this book as though Mr. Styron didn't get, We should give him the benefit of the doubt, maybe, in some respects, because he didn't know that his book was going to get all of this attention. He didn't know that he was going to get all of these accolades. Anything, I've said this so many times on the Cows, anything where harm is being done to black people, inaccurate information is being promoted about black people, white people cannot, for any reason, get the benefit of the doubt. I do not know that William Styron could have known this. This could have all been planned, that you write this book about Nat Turner and you say that he was gay or that he loved a white woman or whatever else you want to throw in, that you and James Baldwin hung out and put this book together and you studied. You get it all together how you want to do it. Bam, we'll put it out, we'll publish it, we'll make sure that you get the Pulitzer, all these other awards, we'll get you on the speaking tour, we'll get you on 60, whatever we need to do, we got it worked out. That sort of thing happens even right now, 2017 white supremacy, so I certainly believe it's possible that could have happened then, and even if that's not the case, who cares? We had an admission this week, Mr. Styron's book is not accurate. I don't need anything else. I don't need any more information. I don't have to think about it. I don't need to give him the benefit of the doubt. If we have a white person who is giving out false information dealing with racism, white supremacy, or anything else, That is an act of racism, and that's it. I don't have anything to say about it. He shouldn't be defended, supported. We shouldn't be trying to go and find ways to justify or rationalize. And in my view, that just shows our conditioning in the system of white supremacy. And this sort of thing happens a lot. I think even since it was mentioned, we just talking about Timothy Tyson's book on Emmett Till. We had Keith Beauchamp on the program. I think we had some of the exact same behavior patterns of making excuses. Timothy Tyson, white author, writing about a deceased black person. Same thing. Why are you doing these things? You are clearly engaged in incorrect behavior. Mr. Tyson wasn't charged with spreading lies about Emmett Till, but he was charged with helping a white woman conceal her lies about this case, which is also incorrect racist behavior. In my opinion, it's the same thing where Mr. Beauchamp, he was making up all these excuses about Mr. Tyson, or maybe he didn't know, or maybe he just didn't realize. I think he said the same thing. He didn't know that his book was going to get so much attention. None of these excuses make sense. We should really work to avoid making any excuses for white people under any circumstances, especially if a black person is being harmed or misrepresented. Continuing. Let's see. I thought it was great when the passage where he talks about Turner's skull being missing. And it kind of becoming irrelevant whether this actually is Turner's authentic skull. Just the fact that a skull that is believed to have belonged to a Negro is valuable, an heirloom. This is something that I want to pass down from generation to generation. Reminded me there was a clip on NPR from some years back where a white man, he was with his granddaughter. They were playing cards, and she beat him. So he gave his granddaughter, she was less than 10, this is a child, he gave her, it was like a bill. It was a publication from a hanging where these three black males were hanged. And there was suspicion that this was probably unjust. Imagine that. But they got hanged. That was his gift to his daughter that he had saved. Like this was a cherished memento. You have this sort of thing all the time. Mr. Fuller has talked about that, where you have white people, they end up with a black person's genitals in a jar, or their testicles in a jar, that this is white culture. And I loved how he dissected all of that and just saying it really doesn't matter, that when you have the safeguarding, I'm reading, the safeguarding of the skull and treating it like a cherished family heirloom demonstrates that well into the late 20th century, 1900s, the possession of Turner's cannibalized body had social and historic significance for whites. You had better believe it. And I see that continuing on as long as racism, white supremacy exists, that will be the case. Continuing, probably last few things that I get in, and then I'll double check, see if anybody else has additional commentary, even though I did take a lot of notes today. A lot of things stood out to me in this section of the reading. We had, again, the worship of John Brown. We can go, I think that was one of the reasons Dick Gregory will never return to the cows and despises Gus T. Renegade. He can join the club. But he worshiped, literally, he sang praises in worship of John Brown both times he was on the program. We got the same thing here, where he writes that Frederick Douglass, writing to Harriet Tubman, says, "Accepting John Brown of sacred memory, I know of no one who has willingly encountered more perils and hardships to serve our enslaved people than you have." I have to gag. He is a victim of racism, white supremacy, for sure. But just imagine that. Harriet Tubman, enslaved, everything that she did, risking her life repeatedly to go back and rescue untold numbers of enslaved black people. The only person who has done more than you is white John Brown. Continuing. Let's see. It seemed like at times he was acknowledging, even though he didn't indict William Styron's work as an act of racism, but it did seem like at times he was acknowledging the nefariousness of this literature. And I thought it was great putting this in the same vein as something like Camp of Saints or the Turner Diaries. Thought that was great and accurate completely, where this is Vincent Woodard saying, The rampant church bombings, lynchings, and assassinations of the 1960s supported Wilson's assertions. Styron's novel only exacerbated the myths and social fictions that fueled this institutionalized violence against African American persons. I just feel like there shouldn't be any equivocating. We shouldn't be going back and forth. Well, he wasn't exactly accurate, and he did exacerbate many of the racist traditions, literal and figurative violence against black people, but he was presenting some great aspects of slavery, you know, and this homoerotic behavior that just to me is folly. And could even be white influence. This book was published after Mr. Woodard passed. Let's see, last couple things I'll get in, and then I'll double check with callers, see if they have anything else that they want to present. I was curious about the phrasing that he used with some of these accusations when he's talking about this collective of black males, including Vincent Harding and James O'Killen and others who responded to William Styron. And I think this is why Mr. Fuller's concept of VGQ, Victims Guarantee Qualification, to kind of stop this process of black people critiquing how other black people respond to racism, white supremacy, and making it sound like, well, I'm going to go back and, you know, fault find with how you were responding to racist William Styron. I think that's why he came up with the VGQ concept, to kind of curtail some of that activity. But where Harding, he writes that where radical individuals such as Turner, Martin Luther King Jr., and George Jackson could not be eaten, the assumption was that a Luke, a raped black man depicted in the Harriet Jacobs slave narrative, a James L. Smith, or a contemporary James Baldwin could be consumed. I thought that was interesting. Just it seemed like sometimes he's either saying that the assumption or what it suggests, where these people haven't said these things explicitly. This is his interpretation. And I think that came up before. I think last week some people were questioning Vincent Woodard, the author's, his interpretation of Frederick Douglass's writing, and whether or not he was, you know, giving some sort of covert signaling about his sexual violation at the hands of white males on the plantation. I think that came up before. I think maybe last two things that I will get in. I spoke to a pretty black female this week, and I mentioned Herbert Aptheker's American Negro Slave Revolts, which does have a lot of constructive information, even though it's written by a white man. But I just mentioned that book this week, which I think Roz nabbed for me off of my wish list. And let's see, one more thing I'll get in. Yeah, like the passage where he says, more than anything, black men and women felt strongly compelled to protect the image of the black family, black masculinity, and black motherhood and womanhood as sustained in the context of slavery. Within this recreated and imagined context, there was no room for a complicated understanding of homoeroticism during slavery. Just that right there. I have a substantial problem with that way of processing this event, if we're talking about Styron's novel, because that's what it is. If we have a concession, Woodard has admitted Styron lied. If a white man is lying and black people call him on that, they accurately pick out what you're saying is not true. It's not true, and we believe that you have racist intent for presenting these lies. Why are we coming back and saying, well, wait a minute, we should, you know, interpret this and allow room, even though he's presented some lies, we should still allow room for his lies so that we can get a greater, more full understanding of homoeroticism and slavery. That, again, is absolute folly, and to me seems like the type of thing that racists would promote now, 2017. To promote sexual confusion, anything where we can insert, oh, yeah, we got to get our gay rights agenda in. Oh, yeah, we got to get our LGBTQI, any other letters that get added. Oh, yeah, we got to get that in. Gay rights, gay rights, gay rights. And particularly if it's time to talk about racism. And I would just say it seems to me never miss an opportunity to indict black people as being homophobic. That has been a trend in my view for a number of years. I'd say at least the last 5 to 10 years rolling strong and worldwide, not just in this part of the world. I think I can stop there, even though I had a number of other notes as well. A lot of things stood out to me in this section. Yeah, the second, let me make sure I get that in. Yeah, where he says black men were not interested in or capable of dealing with the complex legacy of cannibalism. I reject that. That's the sort of thing, the comment that I would make, that I would expect from racists, where we can be that heavy-handed in indicting black people and black males specifically in this and saying that they were just not capable of accepting or dealing with the harsh realities of slavery, as opposed to, no, these black people who had a problem with this book recognized white lies and responded accordingly. There, I'll stop. Other folks who have commentary, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Guys, brilliant. Just completely brilliant assessment. Some of the last stuff you were discussing, I agree with you, is patently false. And I just think that, in my opinion, it's all about normalizing homosexuality as a viable choice for black people. And it seems like if it's the author that's writing this stuff, those particular things, then that is basically the direction he's leaning in, which would also lend to the fact that this book has gotten critical acclaim in those sexually deviant circles, academically speaking. And also, when you discussed, at one point earlier, you discussed the rape of Sally Hemings, first of all, then white people describing it as a relationship and not as rape, and how, it's not going to make you rethink human sexuality, and that the fact that it was rape, period. Again, it's about normalizing the sexual abuse of black people. That's exactly what it is. No different to Sally Hemings' bathroom being refurbished and rebuilt. And they're claiming that it's for, historical purposes, so people could see, exactly where she lived and what it was like. No, it's about actually paying homage to the rape that took place wholesale in that environment for that black female, and the fact that Thomas Jefferson raped her so proficiently that she had multiple children by him. So that's really what it's about. White people love to commemorate their genocide and terrorism against non-white people, and most specifically black people, and that's exactly what that is. And then when you brought up Cleo Monago, I thought that was pretty brilliant. I just find, and I agree with you in reference to that statement as well, about you cannot have a rational discussion about black homosexuality with black people or black males. I think it was the quote. But how does one speak rationally about a non-rational, unnatural act? I don't understand how you have a rational discussion about something like sodomy, which is unnatural in the first place and not something that was inherent in black culture until we encountered white people and Arab people. As far as this, if you're studying African history, that is just the reality. That's something I have personally done. This is something that many, many brilliant grandsisters before me have studied and came to the same conclusion. So, I mean, it just doesn't make sense. And there's no rationale for sodomy. There just is no rationale for it. If that is someone's sexual preference, then that's fine. What you do in the bedroom has nothing to do with my personal life. It's not impinging on my freedom or my ability to do the things that I want to do. So be it, if that's what you wish to do. But don't try to make it a natural, normal act when, excuse me, the only animal that makes a culture out of something that completely does not propagate life is the white human, and now they've converted the non-white people and infected them with the same psychology and psychosexual behavior, and now it's perpetuated in the forms of things that Mr. Monago is trying to propagate. So I agree with you emphatically. Brilliant assessment, sir. Thanks again, and I'll mute my line.
Any other?
Yes, sir. Yes, one last point. On page 186, it said that James Baldwin, he was, I guess, speaking on Styron's book. For it was Baldwin who praised his friend's work highly. Baldwin, who saw himself in Styron's Turner, and Baldwin who dared to say, "This is the beginning of our common history." In a Newsweek interview, Baldwin actually referred to Styron as constructed our common history. And I'll mute my line on that.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
In regards to Frederick Douglass's worship of John Brown and Harriet Tubman, what's ironic about it is John Brown was actually quoted as calling Harriet Tubman General Tubman and calling her the bravest and best person on the continent. So it's very ironic that, like you said, Frederick Douglass would worship John Brown, and you have Harriet Tubman as one of your contemporaries who has probably done more than you in regards to anti-slavery stuff. So I'll mute my line.
For sure. I thought, just real quick, and then I'll hush. I also thought it was interesting, that line, important, where he's quoting from, this is James Baldwin, where he's quoted in Newsweek as saying it'll be called, where he's, this is, I guess, the opening salvo before the novel comes out, Styron's novel comes out. He said, it'll be called Effrontery. Bill's going to catch it from black and white. It's a very courageous book that attempts to fuse the two points of view, the master's and the slave. It's important for the black reader to see what Bill is trying to do and to recognize its validity. I don't even know if I could have included that quote other than it would have to be, well, he was incorrect because the novel was not valid. It was false. And even the author had to acknowledge that it was false. Vincent Woodard says it was false. I mean, we cannot play with words. If we're going to have that and he's saying that it's valid, that is not true. The book was false. He lied. He was called out on it correctly. And anytime you have a white person lying about anything related to racism, that is pretty major. That's heavy timber, as they say. That's not something that, you know, we can play around with or minimize. Oh, he was just messing around. He had a tough day. He's still cool. He marched with Dr. King and he hung out with James Baldwin at his house for a year. So he can't be a racist. Other folks have comment. I'm sure that was rolling in. I'm sure they pulled that one. Styron can't be a racist. He hung out with James Baldwin all last year. Anybody else have commentary before we get to the second audio segment? Everybody satisfied? Grands. We will get to audio segment number two. We should have ample time if you have additional comments or if you just didn't get to share or if you, for whatever reason, maybe it's loud right now, just make a note if you have anything else that you want to get in, and we should have ample time once the second audio segment concludes. So we're picking up the subtitle. We're still in chapter five. The subtitle is A Slave Kiss. I was hoping that we were going to be able to do the entire chapter five today, but we're just missing like the last page or two. I tried my best, but all we're missing is the last couple pages. We'll get that next week. But this is almost the remainder of chapter five, Eating Nat Turner. This is Vincent Woodard's The Delectable Negro Human Consumption and Homoeroticism in U.S. Slave Culture, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number two.
A Slave Kiss. I'll now turn to the novel as a vehicle for exploring this issue of common history, as Baldwin conceived of it through Styron's text. Rather than dealing with the black-white homoerotic dynamic, I want to examine a scene in the novel that deals with same-sex eroticism between two black men, Nat Turner and his boyhood friend Willis. The Riverside scene in The Confessions of Nat Turner is a tender, disturbing, and complex depiction of black male need and desire. I say this knowing full well that black scholars at the time expressed feelings of disgust and betrayal about this scene. They referred it as simply masturbation, homosexuality, and a depiction of Nat Turner as a homosexual. We are introduced to Willis as an orphan. His mother dies from a lung complaint, which brings the youth to the attention of one of Turner's former masters. In this depiction of Willis as motherless and fatherless, Styron, who failed on many historical counts, captured a true reality of slavery. So many young black boys during slavery found themselves without mother and father as a result of the auction block, disease, and violence. Nat observes Willis working and is enraptured by something irresistible in the youth, his gaiety, his innocent, open disposition, his song that accompanies his work. In the novel, Turner describes Willis as a slim, beautiful boy with fine bone features, very gentle and wistful in repose, and the light glistened like oil on his smooth black skin. Ever since meeting Willis, Turner has worked diligently to convert the heathen Willis to the truth of Christian belief. Willis believes in omens and conjuring. He wears a mojo or fetish of his own construction. Willis has decorated his mojo fetish with the long hairs from the cock of a bull that had died on of the bloat. He had tied up three fuzzy patches on his head to ward off ghosts. The fangs of a water moccasin he wore on a string around his neck, a charm against fever. This scene has an eerie historical familiarity, this relationship between the black enlightened subject and the black heathen, the decorous, literate speech of Turner contrasting against the guileless, obscene ways of folk. Frederick Douglass constructs a similar dynamic between himself and Sandy, a root-working black elder. He refers to Sandy and all slaves who believe in conjure like Sandy as the more ignorant slave. In his preparatory research for his novel, Styron read the slave narrative of Frederick Douglass and numerous others, and it could have very well been from Douglass's narrative or that of another slave that Styron first gleaned an understanding of this dynamic between enlightened and heathen slave. Returning to the text, Turner and Willis sit at the riverside one weekend fishing and enjoying each other's company. Both boys typically went fishing together on Saturdays and Sundays. This particular weekend will change the course of their relationship and history itself. This is the fateful weekend when they will kiss and masturbate one another. Shortly after their arrival, Willis pricks his finger with a hook or the sharp spine of a fish. Instinctively, he cries out, "Fucking Jesus!" Turner, a devout Christian with a missionary zeal, swiftly rapped him sharply across the lips, drawing a tiny runnel of blood. Turner punctuates this act by proclaiming to the shocked Willis, "A filthy mouth is an abomination unto the Lord." Turner's violent response to Willis calls to mind 19th century black missionaries who traveled all the way to Africa to civilize and save so-called African heathens from extinction. Black culture has been, if anything, a long uphill battle against the heathen without and within. Styron exploited this theme for his own ends, but there is still this truth at the heart of this scenario, a truth made all the more complicated and disturbing when intermingled with the theme of homosexuality. After Turner strikes Willis, a whirlwind of emotions grip the two. Willis affects a broken, hurt look. Turner is, in turn, overcome with emotion. "I felt a pang of guilt and pain at my anger, and a rush of pity swept through me, mingled with a hungry tenderness that stirred me in a way I have never known." This hunger and rush of feeling gives way to touch and forbidden warmth. Turner describes Willis's eyes as brimming with tears, then flashes onto the moccasin fangs dangling at his neck, bone white and startling against his shiny, bare black chest. "I reach up to wipe away the blood from his lips, pulling him near with the feel of his shoulders slippery beneath my hand. And then we somehow fell on each other, very close, soft, and comfortable, in a sprawl like babies. Beneath my exploring fingers, his hot skin throbbed and pulsed like the throat of a pigeon. And I heard him sigh in a faraway voice, and then for a long moment, as if set free unto another land, we did with our hands together what, before, I had done alone. Never had I known that human flesh could be so sweet." Willis is Africa in the flesh. He is the African infant compared to Turner, who plays the role of the enlightened paternal Negro, a type of New World black missionary. Styron depicts homoeroticism as a complex affair shaped in part by discourses of African eroticization, Negro socialization, and Christian indoctrination. As I mentioned earlier, black reviewers and commentators accused Styron of exoticizing and further indoctrinating black men in the scene. Poussant read this scene as the psychological disfigurement of Turner and, as well, his emasculation. Referring to this Willis Turner scene, he asks, "What is the communication here?" His response, as we have seen, "Naturally, it implies that Nat Turner was not a man at all." Poussant's observations are complicated, for they speak to homosexuality used, in this instance, to dislocate Turner from his natal origins and as a tool to get inside of Turner in order to expose the erotic and sexual confusion underlying his revolutionary politics. Styron uses, and I would agree, abuses the idea of homosexuality in this instance. Styron's depiction of the Willis-Turner dynamic speaks to a historical dialectic between black men dating back to slavery. As mentioned earlier, one can see the seeds of Willis and Turner in Frederick Douglass's depiction of the more African-like elderly Sandy and himself in his first slave narrative. He describes Sandy as believing in conjure. Sandy takes him out to a wooded area to recover a certain root, which, according to Douglass, would render it impossible for Mr. Covey or any other white man to whip me. As with Turner, it is not the root, according to Douglass, that sets him free, but his life-or-death struggle against the slave-breaker Covey that returns his lost manhood to him. Douglass and Sandy do not actually kiss, but they are nevertheless bound by the very same cord of heathen versus civilized, infantilized versus manly black man that binds Turner to Willis in the novel. The 19th century black religious leader Alexander Crummell thought of the African heathen as licentious, someone to be civilized off the face of the planet. In essays and speeches, he imagined the African heathen as seductive, wielding the same power and sinful allure that Willis wields over Nat. W.E.B. Du Bois, a protege of Crummell, described the Negro of the South as tainted with African beliefs and heathen practices. The Negro has already been pointed out many times as a religious animal, a being of that deep emotional nature which turns instinctively towards the supernatural. He called up all the resources of heathenism to aid, exorcism and witchcraft, the mysterious Obi worship with its barbarous rites, spells, and blood sacrifice even now and then of human victims. Weird midnight orgies and mystic conjurations were invoked, the witch woman and the voodoo priest became the center of Negro group life, and that vein of vague superstition which characterizes the unlettered Negro even today was deepened and strengthened. Du Bois romanticizes, even eroticizes, the very black folk that he seeks to liberate from the emotional and spiritual clutches of American history. As a lettered Negro, Du Bois' experiences and sense of self are counterbalanced by the heathen sensibility contained in the body and social practices of the unlettered Negro. Du Bois feels seduced by and is at the same time repulsed by this Negro whom he describes as bloodthirsty, sexually licentious, massive and erotically overpowering, and even cannibalistic in his urges and rituals. In his review of Claude McKay's novel, Home to Harlem, Du Bois more explicitly coupled his idea of something heathen in the folk with homosexuality and sexual abandon in artistic culture of the Harlem Renaissance. Such evidence at least hints of something much deeper than the offense-taking that characterizes black people's knee-jerk response to the Willis-Turner scene in Styron's novel. Perhaps a deeper fear of recognition is operating, for a real acknowledgement of something essentially black and the Willis-Turner dynamic would necessitate a rethinking of constructs such as the color line and problematics such as the Negro problem, as having been from their inceptive moments imbricated with a black homoerotic discourse. I think that this might have been some of what Baldwin was trying to get at through the double implications of our common history. Where others saw void and absence, nothing of nation, community, or the black self in homoeroticism. Baldwin saw homoeroticism as being, in some ways, most representative of racial experience. An example from Baldwin's book-length essay, No Name in the Streets, illustrates this point. Baldwin has come from a self-imposed exile in Paris to the U.S. South to observe and report on the civil rights conditions there. He interviews children who are integrating schools and their family members, black ministers, white sheriffs, and governors, among other persons, in each city he travels to. At one point in his observations, at a loss for examples to explain the incestuous thread that binds white men to black men in the South, Baldwin relates the experience of being sexually groped by a drunken white state official. "I realized that I was being groped by one of the most powerful men in one of the states I visited. He had got himself sweating drunk in order to arrive at this despairing titillation. With his wet eyes staring up at my face and his wet hands groping for my cock, we were both abruptly in history's ass pocket. It was frightening. Not the gesture itself, but the abjectness of it." The broader implications of this secret desire for black male flesh, black male cock, are that black people in the South are at the mercy of men such as this who pull and press the levers that run Jim Crow machinery. This white man was one of the men you called, had a friend call, in order to get your brother off the prison farm. A phone call from him might prevent your brother from being dug up later during some random archaeological expedition. Baldwin demonstrates how homosexual desire is seamlessly intertwined with the legacy of American slavery and black civil identity in the South. It was even conceivable to him that were it not for the migration of black men out of the South post-emancipation, the entire region might have become an absolutely homosexual community, wherein white male desire for black men was more open and socially acceptable. There is a fluid correlation in Baldwin's mind between this white man reaching for his cock and the castration of black men in the context of lynching rituals. The black exercise of the right to vote, school integration, and the over-incarceration of black men on chain gang and in jails. Baldwin's sexual encounter counters the idea that if a black man were doing the fucking of a white man, then his manhood remained intact and he could be considered revolutionary, a notion that many black power advocates silently entertained. State-sanctioned racial oppression, at this scenario demonstrates, pairs well with homoeroticism. The homosexual oppression of black men overlaps with and feeds seamlessly into larger systems of racial oppression. And to say just a bit more about the sexual implications of this scene, just because the white man was reaching for Baldwin's penis does not mean that the man sought sexual penetration. He may have wanted to penetrate Baldwin. He may have wanted oral gratification, one way or the other. I could speculate endlessly about the sexual particulars of this scenario, but what we know for sure is that Baldwin himself finally clarifies, which is that it is absolutely certain that white men, who invented the nigger's big black prick, are still at the mercy of this nightmare, and are still, for the most part, doomed in one way or another to attempt to make this prick their own. No matter what form the sex takes, the white man's power will not be compromised. Having access to big black prick, Baldwin infers, is constitutive of the state-sanctioned power of the white official that he encounters. A number of scholars have experienced frustration at Baldwin's slippery relationship to an outright rejection of a homosexual identity and politics. However, this excerpt from No Name in the Street clarifies how Baldwin sees homosexuality in terms of black experience and black male identity formation as buried or methodologically disguised in racial logic in the history of slavery and in the psychological workings of the Southern racial ideology. For Baldwin, homosexuality does not and cannot ever exist as something isolated from racial formation. Brian R. Washington, agreeing with this last statement, notes that in Baldwin's writing, An Overarching Cosmology of Race and Sex, blackness and homosexuality are not simply coterminous. They are virtually interchangeable. The encounter between himself and the white official helps us better understand why Baldwin would support Styron's freedom to imagine and inhabit Nat Turner and all the lurid homosexual implications of that habitation. For how else were the unspeakable fantasies and suppressed homosexual desires of Southern white men going to be exposed and potentially exercised? This subtle level of discourse was lost upon and completely ignored in the prevailing black commentary and debates that centered on Styron's novel. There was the general opinion that Styron was constructing a white, Southern, neo-slave master's version of black American history. Most view Jane Baldwin's contention that Styron was constructing our common history as at best a misguided perception and at worst as white apologist sentiment. Still, there is a solid ethos informing Baldwin's statement. As a black homosexual who was not afraid to speak publicly about being groped by a white man, Baldwin occupied a unique position that allowed him to understand how desire and sexuality transcended and confounded racial thinking. In his essay, Down at the Cross, Letter from a Region in My Mind, Baldwin refers to whites and blacks as having to come together as lovers in order to achieve America's loftiest ideals and transcend the prison of racial ideology. Everything now, we must assume, is in our hands. We have no right to assume otherwise. If we, and now I mean the relatively conscious whites and the relatively conscious blacks, who must, like lovers, insist on or create the consciousness of the others, do not falter in our duty now, we may be able, handful that we are, to end the racial nightmare and achieve our country. For black men, the problem with this idea of the lovers, in particular homoerotic lovers, in Styron's novel, was not so much the image of homoeroticism, but the twisted spectral pleasure that whites took in Styron's depiction of black sexuality. Killens, from 10 Black Men Respond, likened the white review community, journals, and the Pulitzer Prize Committee itself to whoremongers. Recording his feelings after reading a review of the novel in the New York Times Review of Books, he writes, "I had this uncomfortable feeling that a hoax was being perpetrated against the American reading public. I also had the uneasy feeling, even worse, that the reading public dearly loved me. Like a whore being brutally ravished and loving every masochistic minute of it." Killens had justification for feeling the way he did. In the 1930s, psychologists and sexologists from Sigmund Freud to Richard Craftaby documented that some Europeans achieved sexual arousal through romanticized images of slaves. Craftaby, who coined the term masochism, includes in his compendium on sexual pathology the following letter from a self-diagnosed masochist. Case 57. "Even in my early childhood, I loved to revel in ideas about the absolute mastery of one man over another. The thought of slavery had something exciting in it for me, alike whether from the standpoint of master or servant. That one man could possess, sell, or whip another caused me intense excitement. And in reading Uncle Tom's Cabin, which I read at the beginning of puberty, I had erections." In her study of masochistic desire, Marcia Marcus listed childhood books that provided materials for her own adolescent masochistic fantasies. There were the books about boarding school, in which small boys slaved for the bigger boys. There were books about the initiation rites of exotic people. There was Uncle Tom's Cabin and other books about black slaves in America. from the antebellum period, critiques of Stowe's novel by white Southern men revealed how these men themselves associated sexual license and impurity with the novel and often read into many of its scenes as pornographic subtext. These men, themselves titillated by the novel, wanted to limit and ultimately prevent its distribution. When it came to slavery, the concept of love, intimacy, and desire between white and black men had been for the longest time shot through with violence, with white erotic voyeurism, in a precarious politics of white empathy and sentimentalism. Baldwin understood this legacy. He found Stowe's novel, for example, to be riddled with sentimentality, the type of sentimentality that is an excuse for violent inhumanity, the mask of cruelty that made objects of the slave among both abolitionists and plantation workers. Baldwin even goes as far to link Richard Wright Bigger Thomas with Stowe's Tom, asserting that Bigger is Uncle Tom's descendant, flesh of his flesh. So exactly opposite a portrait that, when the books are placed together, it seems the contemporary Negro novelist and the dead New England woman are locked together in a deadly, timeless battle. Bigger Thomas rapes a white woman and obsesses over white femininity as symbol and prize. Stowe, on the other hand, obsessed over black male virility while domesticating it, packaging it, and emotionally mastering it so as to ward off the unspoken threat of the black beast, the rapist. Baldwin understood how this legacy of black men, fixated either upon white women or white men, had prevented black men from developing more complex models of masculinity and of black male sexuality. For 10 Black Men Respond was just that, a response to white representations of and appetites for blackness. It was black men primarily engaged with white men and white institutional structures at the expense of a more private, long overdue discussion of these same issues among black men. Styron's novel presented Baldwin with the perfect opportunity to publicize and mediate the subject of homoerotic connection between black and white men and among black men during slavery. In a Newsweek interview, Baldwin acknowledged his identification with Styron Turner. "Yes," he admitted, "I think that there's some of me in that Turner. If I were an actor, I could play the part." Baldwin would have cause to rethink the statement when, months later, he served as mediator when blacks protested against efforts in Hollywood to make Styron's novel into a film. This statement is loaded with double meaning. It can be read, as many black men read it, that Baldwin was something of a template for Styron's Turner. It also reads as a gesture towards revising the slave past. Baldwin, as person and symbol, impressed upon black people in this moment the possibility of an entirely different script of revolutionary masculinity during slavery. This statement clarifies how the term "our common history" referred to black-white relations on the surface and beneath the surface, to the repressed and denied historical presence of the black homosexual in a genealogy of black radicalism extending back to slavery. Needless to say, black men receive Baldwin's speech and actions across a great divide. While he envisioned a new radical genealogy and pushed, through Styron, for a model of antebellum resistance that included homoeroticism, most black men were still stuck on homosexuality as a derivative of white decadence and as the sexual exploitation of black people. Killens, as a representative of this black constituency, liken white desires to the black homosexual person. He depicts whites as whoremongers. He effeminizes whites and recuperates, in a small way, some of the stolen legacy of black masculinity. He plays upon the Christian dichotomy of the chaste virgin and the filthy whore. Not only is the pristine black revolutionary virtuous and free of such taint, he is also virile, according to Killen's logic, Hence, the white whore's hunger for and pleasure taken in the black male's sexuality in Styron's text. Killen's attempts in this way to recuperate black masculinity and flip the Christian and moral script on the very whites and white institutions that claim an unquestionable moral position. The idea of whoredom definitely struck home and made a powerful point, but it was a point that cut both ways. Within 1960s radical culture, black men applied the same paradigm of the virgin whore to black lesbians, black women who coupled with white men, and black women who asserted themselves in myriad ways, refusing domination by black men. Killen's representation of white sexual appetites as whoredom carried over as well into descriptions of black homosexuals as whores, carriers of filth, and race betrayers. It is no coincidence that Cleaver refers to Baldwin and to Negro homosexuals in his Soul on Ice, published the same year as 10 Black Men Respond, as whores and objects of white masochistic desire. Many Negro homosexuals acquiescing in this racial death wish are outraged and frustrated because in their sickness they are unable to have a baby by a white man. The cross they have to bear is that, already bending over and touching their toes for the white man. The fruit of their miscegenation is not the little half-white offspring of their dreams, but an increase and unwinding of their nerves. Like the whore of Killen's imagination, Cleaver describes a Negro homosexual as a psychopath, an automated slave, and one who looks to the white man as his big daddy, or pimp in the marketplace of white desire. A number of scholars have noted the significance of Cleaver's comments insofar as they reflected a radical black ideology that equated homosexuality with a racial death wish. Bearing the weight of such an attack, Baldwin understood better than any other how white desire, even in the radical black imagination, had intrinsic ties to the metaphoric and real presence of the black homosexual. When Killen spoke of white whoredom, he was already and implicitly speaking to a sexual framework in which females and effeminacy were suspect, and in which the Negro homosexual could, at a moment's notice, serve as a substitute for the body and person of the black female. Long-held assumptions inform Killen's and Cleaver's statements. There is the assumption that black homosexuality originates in the brutality of slavery. The idea that the black male phallus is the only true measure and means of racial continuity, and the idea that black homosexuality is always suspect by virtue of its connection to whiteness. Holding firmly to these assumptions for reasons of political strategy, and the desire to forget what Kaiser refers to as the bestial and lurid details of slavery, resulted in the missed opportunity among black men to speak openly and honestly about their historically charged erotic relations to white men. Black men also missed the opportunity to talk about homoeroticism, same-sex intimacy, need, love, and desire among themselves. Baldwin did not publicly claim a homosexual identity. In fact, he publicly disavowed the labels of homosexual or gay to define his person and art. When called upon to speak on behalf of the race, Baldwin habitually adopted the voice and posture of the angry, emasculated black patriarch. "Protect your women," a difficult thing to do in a civilization sexually so pathetic that the white man's masculinity depends on a denial of the masculinity of the blacks. "Protect your women," in a civilization that emasculates the male and abuses the female, and in which, moreover, the male is forced to depend on the female's breadwinning power. Baldwin was well aware of the dangers of, indeed, the price of the ticket for, trying to synthesize his racial and sexual identities. As Dwight A. McBride points out, his efficacy as a race man was, at least in part, dependent on limiting his public activism to racial politics. Baldwin calls upon a dynamic within the black collective conscious that is as old as slavery, the image of the lynched or emasculated black man and the raped, sexually violated black woman. This dynamic foreclosed a number of other configurations, such as black men sexually violated by white women, black men during slavery who played non-patriarchal roles, and black men who, for whatever reasons, did not sexually reproduce the race. The legacy of the Black Father. Although Baldwin did not claim a homosexual politics, he found himself in a historic moment that desperately needed a politics that linked homosexuality with race and with a legacy of black male sexual violation and sexualization stemming back to slavery. In the corpus of his work, especially in texts such as The Fire Next Time, Go Tell It on the Mountain, and No Name in the Street, Baldwin lays some of the groundwork for his sexual politics that was never fully realized in the context of the Black Power movement. The example that I cite earlier of his being sexually fondled by a white state official demonstrated Baldwin organically theorizing out his sexual subjectivity, a politics of abuse and white homosexual desire that had an effect upon the entire race and the cause of the civil rights movement. Because Baldwin saw himself ultimately as a witness to the truth, as one whose most valuable tools were his experience and person, in much of his writing, Baldwin encodes his racial/sexual politics in his experience, especially those experiences finely attuned to the intimate, unspoken regions of male intimacy and same-sex eroticism. Differing from the popular homosexual politics of the day, this blueprint of black sexual politics linked homoeroticism to the memory and legacy of slavery, expanded the meaning and expressions of black masculinity, and maintained a critical stance towards patriarchal institutions that perpetuated domineering models of black masculinity. In the essay, Down at the Cross, from The Fire Next Time, Baldwin records a meeting between himself and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, leader of the black Muslims. Baldwin recalls being frightened upon receiving the summons from the black leader to come to his house for dinner. "I was frightened because I had, in effect, been summoned unto a royal presence." Baldwin is also afraid, perhaps more afraid, of the tension this meeting inspires in himself, between love and power, between pain and rage. In the leader's home, Baldwin awaits the elder black man while Muhammad's devotees attend to him before dinner. Baldwin experiences the meeting as tense and framed by much unspoken history shared between the two men. Ruminating to himself on the Muslims' belief that whites are devils, Baldwin thinks, "For the horrors of the American Negro's life, there has been almost no language. The privacy of his experience, which is only beginning to be recognized in language, and which is denied or ignored in official and popular speech." More specifically, Baldwin empathizes with Muhammad's own tragic history, which involves seeing his father hang before his eyes. His father's blood rushed out, and as Baldwin has heard it, Muhammad saw the same blood rush down and splash down through the leaves of a tree on a hill. On a trip to Georgia years earlier, Baldwin had wondered at how the red clay of the earth had acquired its color from the blood that had dripped down from these trees, Lincoln trees. He thinks of Willie McGee and Emmett Till and the host of unnamed black men lynched for supposedly violating white Southern women. Slave narratives are rife with examples of sons made unto witnesses the momentary and long-term demise of their fathers. Many slaves, like John Jacobs, located their genealogy in a man, a father without authority, a husband, and no protector. Baldwin acknowledges the right and responsibility of both he and Muhammad to claim and interpret this legacy of black male emasculation. Muhammad, on the other hand, privileges his relationship to the legacy of the fathers over that of Baldwin. He equates Baldwin's homosexuality with whiteness and with having strayed from the race. he seeks to convert the invert before him, and in the posture of a paternal figure, he expresses concern for Baldwin's salvation, his safety in the white world. In his confusion about what it truly means to be responsible to one's ancestral inheritance, Baldwin leaves Muhammad's home with strong feelings of longing, unrequited need, and objection. I felt very close to him and really wished to be able to love and honor him as a witness, an ally, and a father. I thought that I knew something of his pain and his fury, and yes, even his beauty. Baldwin had come from a religious family. His father, a minister in the Baptist Church, was a man who inspired in him intense feelings of love, resentment, and competition. Through his father and by virtue of his own ancestral connections to the South, Baldwin had just as much right as Muhammad to make of the legacy of paternal pain that united them. The contestation over the meaning of the unspeakable past dictated Baldwin's interactions with Muhammad, and a decade later, strongly influenced his relationship to the black men of 10 Black Writers Respond. Elijah Muhammad and the black man from Clark's edited collection maintain one narrative of paternal pain, familial role, gender, and sexuality, and Baldwin, by virtue of his erotic and tribal relationship to the black father, maintains another. At stake here are, in part, central questions of racial origins. Where do black people, and in particular, where does black masculinity come from? What is the ideal image of this masculine identity, and what does this image of black manhood have to do with a larger racial liberation project? Muhammad and others draw upon a century-old model of black masculinity originating out of violent, emasculating black-white relations. However, Baldwin shifts the discussion of this violence away from black-white dynamic to a deeper terrain, the interior world of longing and pain perpetuated by and shared among black men. In his first novel, Go Tell It on the Mountain, Baldwin situates the origins of black masculinity in a racial mythology dating back to the first contact between European and coastal Africa. The Curse of Ham is a myth of racial origins that deals with incest, homoerotic desire, and slave legacy between black son and father. The Curse of Ham is one of the oldest racial mythologies used by whites to justify their inhuman treatment of the African and black American. The curse involves a son, Ham, looking upon the naked body of his father, Noah. As a result of looking at or touching his father, it is not clear which, the descendants of Ham are to be slaves. During slavery, black men interpreted the curse in a number of different ways, as an explanation of their infantilized relationship to white slave owners, as an explanation for why they descended from the tribe of Cush rather than the tribe of Canaan, the curse son, and as a way of talking about the introduction of white blood into an African lineage. Curiously missing from most discussions of the curse is a reference to its overt homoerotic implications. The son looking upon the father's nakedness and responding with desire or even erotic touch. Baldwin explored the homoerotic implications of this racial mythology through the characters of John, the son, and Gabriel, the father, in Go Tell It on the Mountain. Baldwin reenacts the curse of Ham by having John, while scrubbing his father's back in the bathtub, look down upon his father's nakedness as Ham had originally done to Noah. Yes, he had sinned. One morning, alone, in the dirty bathroom, in the square, dirt-gray cupboard room that was filled with the stink of his father. Sometimes, leaning over and cracked, paddle-tail-gray bathtub, he scrubbed his father's back and looked, as the accursed son of Noah had looked on his father's hideous nakedness. It was a secret, like sin, and slimy like the serpent, and heavy like the rod. Then he hated his father, and longed for the power to cut his father down. as with Turner and Willis from the Confessions of Nat Turner. Religion frames the tense relationship between John and his father. Gabriel, who sits in the bathtub, is a deacon in their local Harlem Baptist Church. Gabriel was called to the ministry as a youth and practices a type of Southern Christianity that dates back to slavery. It is in the context of desire for and hatred toward his father that John attempts to understand larger questions of racial origins and the grander cosmic meaning behind the enslavement and dislocation of Africans. Referring even more directly to the biblical curse in his blood, he laments, "This, and not that other, his deadly sin, having looked on his father's nakedness and mocked and cursed him in his heart. Ah, that son of Noah had been cursed, down to the present groaning generation, a servant of servants shall he be until his brethren." Baldwin's use of and representation of homosexuality in Go Tell It on the Mountain goes far beyond sex act and contemporary homosexual politics. While the scenario between John and his father speaks to the intrinsic way that homoeroticism has, from the very beginnings, figured centrally in the mythic, originary landscape of African-American experience. While blacks have worked hard to construct a mythology of the race-based and the male-female conjugal union and Adam and Eve as mythic gender prototypes, Baldwin exposes a different racial genealogy rooted in the homoerotic interchange between father and son, between black male compatriots and brothers. This other unspeakable homoerotic legacy was an even more painful and raw wound for black men. But how could black men talk about need, desire, and eroticism among themselves without also talking about the numerous ways in the context of slavery in which such intimate ties had been denied, violently circumvented, or routed through the body and person of a white master, overseer, or some other ruling class white? In so many ways, this history was repeated in Styron, whom whites billed as an authentic and authoritative interpreter of black male experience and motivations. The other homosexual scene in Styron's novel that stirred up great amount of controversy focused on Ether T. Branly, an assistant plantation overseer. Harding describes Brantley as a social outcast among whites, a mentally retarded, personally repulsive homosexual whose speciality seems to be the molesting of young boys. Brantley is attracted to Turner's preaching, which has the effect, according to Harding, of diminishing the personal charisma and visionary message of Turner in the novel. Styron does paint a despicable picture of Brantley. His face is pockmarked, and he exudes a flatulence that smells like air from a swamp bottom. Added to all of this is the fact that he is a confessed child molester. As I note in earlier chapters, it was not unusual for the homoerotic appetites of the overseer to spill over into the punishment of enslaved persons. And while I agree with Harding that Styron does attempt to use Brantley to diminish the power of Turner, there is also the real and largely unexplored sexual history between overseers and male slaves. This history is present in the violent interchange between Douglas and Covey. But what black scholars such as Harding have preferred to emphasize is the violent exchange, the fight until liberty or death, instead of examining the complicated ways slaves had to negotiate the homoerotics of plantation life.
Context of white supremacy, and we'll pick up there. Like I said, we're right at the close of chapter 5. I was hoping to get the whole thing in today, just missed a couple of pages right at the end there that we will nab next Friday. With that, if folks have commentary that they would like to share, the number to dial is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-#. Press *6 if you would like to participate. We have about a half hour, a little over a half hour remaining in the program. So get your hand up right now. Please do not wait until the very end, last 5 minutes. If you think you have comments that you would like to share, go ahead and speak up now. All the folks who dialed in who have a hand up, line should be open. Feel free to chime in if you have commentary. Folks that are with us, Mr. Demery 4, Emmy, Roz, I'll nab other lines as I see her. Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you. I was having trouble getting to my mute button. I apologize. I find this writing very interesting, and I just find that there's quite a bit, just like you did in the previous reading, quite a bit of suggestive commentary towards normalizing homosexuality as this, this not acknowledged aspect of African-American history, and that it needs to be given its space within the context of general Black sexuality. And it's kind of nauseating because it's just something that now has become an epidemic, something used epidemically in amongst Black people by white people in order to propagate our genocide. So I just find it kind of tacky and nauseating. But in the very beginning of the second reading, the author writes, "I'll now turn to the novel as a vehicle for exploring the issue of common history, as Baldwin conceived of it through Styron's text. Rather than dealing with the Black-white homoerotic dynamic, I want to examine a scene in the novel that deals with same-sex eroticism between two young Black men, Nat Turner and his boyfriend, Willis. The Riverside scene in The Confessions of Nat Turner is a tender, disturbing, and complex depiction of Black male need and desire. I say this knowing full well that Black scholars at the time expressed feelings of disgust and betrayal about this scene. They referred to it simply as masturbation, quote-unquote, sex homosexuality, quote-unquote, and a depiction of Nat Turner as a homosexual. And the section that I wanted to highlight was where he states, he says that the Confessions of Nat Turner is a tender, disturbing, and complex depiction of Black male need and desire. What's tender about sodomy between men? And I don't understand, because everything about homosexuality is really about the person who lives that lifestyle, their interpretation of what being a Black female is really all about. So that, to me, is also a part of the mental illness aspect of so-called homosexual culture, in the sense that it's really a Black male's interpretation of what they think Black females are like and should be like. And then they're trying to emulate it, even though they don't have the physical attributes of or the sexual apparatus of a Black female. So to me, that just right there depicts, again, what I was just saying about the attempted normalization of homosexuality as this normal aspect of African-American sexual expression. So I just find that pretty much quite a bit coming up throughout the reading. On page 191, he writes, "Baldwin demonstrates how homosexual desire is seamlessly intertwined with the legacy of American slavery and Black civil identity in the South. It was even conceivable to him that were it not for the migration of Black men out of the South post-emancipation, the entire region might have become an absolutely homosexual community, wherein white male desire for Black men was more open and socially acceptable." Wow. Again, this speaks to the wholesale psychosexual culture of white males being a homosexual undercurrent and undertone to their entire historical existence. And that just ties into something that I said before in the show, that I've never really seen or met a white male that did not exhibit homosexuality, no matter how or homoeroticism, no matter how seemingly masculine they came across, even if they were big and had muscles and they lifted weights and all of that stuff. I've just heard numerous stories of white men who supposedly would have the image of being the most masculine white males doing the most homosexual things and finding it funny and acceptable and normal behavior for, quote unquote, growing young men and things of that nature. So to me, their entire culture has just historically been that way. And ultimately, you know, this is also being proven throughout this entire text. Shortly below, there's a brief paragraph that writes, it is as that way the author writes, and it says, quote, "It is absolutely certain that white men who invented the nigger's big black prick are still at the mercy of this nightmare and are still, for the most part, doomed in one way or another to attempt to make this prick their own." And that just brought me to think of Dr. Welting. This is speaking of it from a homoerotic standpoint, but again, the idea of the gun and it being their own black penis that they're attempting to make their own. And also the story of James Baldwin discussing being sexually assaulted and terrorized by the, I think it was the a white senator or something of that nature. Excuse me. I tied that in mentally to Donald Trump with the whole situation that came up with him discussing grabbing women by their crotches and shoving his tongue down their throats. It was kind of like the homosexual version of that is what the now ancestor James Baldwin had experienced with that senator. And I just find that to be telling, to be a redux of that in the expression of Donald Trump when he was exposed for that type of behavior. And lastly, I just wanted to touch on page 194. There's a section where the author writes, "I had this uncomfortable feeling that a hoax was being perpetrated against the American reading public. I also had an uneasy feeling, even worse, that the reading public dearly loved it, like a whore being brutally ravished and loving every masochistic minute of it. Killens had justification for feeling the way that he did. In the 1930s, psychologists and sexologists from Sigmund Freud to Richard Kraft Ebing documented that some Europeans achieved sexual arousal through the romanticized image of slaves. Kraft Ebing, who coined the term masochism, quote unquote, excuse me, includes in his compendium on sexual pathology the following letter from a self-diagnosed masochist, case 57. Even in my early childhood, I loved to revel in ideas about the absolute mastery of one man over others. The thought of slavery had something exciting in it for me, alike whether from the standpoint of master or servant. That one man could possess, sell, or whip another caused me intense excitement. And in reading Uncle Tom's Cabin, which I read at the beginning of puberty, I had erections." In her study of masochistic desire, Marcia Marcus lists the childhood books that provided materials for her own adolescent masochistic fantasies. Quote, "There were the books about boarding school in which small boys slaved for the bigger boys. There were books about the initiation rites of exotic people. There was Uncle Tom's Cabin and other books about black slaves in America. From the antebellum period, critiques of Stowe's novel by white Southern men revealed how these men themselves associated sexual, quote, licensee and impurity, unquote, with the novel and often read into many of its scenes a pornographic, quote unquote, subtext. These men themselves, titillated by the novel, wanted to limit and ultimately prevent its distribution." And this just speaks again to both white males and females and their sadomasochistic sexual desires. And this is an undercurrent of white culture that is most violently and volatilely expressed upon the black male and female. And this should give us a lot of pauses to put thought again into the psychopathology of these beasts that we call white people that we have to deal with on a daily basis. I will stop there and give someone else a chance to speak. And if I get the opportunity, I might touch on one last thing later on. Thank you so much, and I'll mute my line.
Other folks have commentary that we're going to share.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I want to confirm or agree or second that I've never met a white male, no matter how quote unquote machismo he came off, like he wanted to present, that did not do or engage in some type of like homoerotic joke, quote unquote, joking or just behavior in general. And it really, really comes out when they drink. I also wanted to comment on that I agree. Like, I wanted to think about it a little bit, but there really is nothing to say that it was just pure terror as to why
Black people didn't speak about certain things, but that what we are allowed to talk about is controlled by white people. I gave that some thought, and I think that would even be true here because, I mean, it would seem like it could be very possible to be experiencing stuff and be experiencing very traumatic experiences and then want to talk about them with other people or share your story. That's like not new just now. I could see that even being then, but not being able to. Even today, certain things are not given a lot of attention or encouraged or supported because that's not what white people want us to be talking about. I'm not, you know, I really do, again, in listening to this piece, feel that the author is really trying to place himself in some type of historical context, which I understand, but I think that creating something out of nothing is false. And not looking at it as, okay, let me say this first. I also disagree with the notion that Black people can't talk about, quote unquote, homosexuality rationally or without getting emotional about it. I think what's really happening is that people who are engaging in homosexual activity or behavior, that's their lifestyle or whatever it is, identify that way, don't like to hear that there's a very strong likelihood that that behavior is symptomatic of some type of like mental illness or some type of like trauma or something like that. So the minute that that's brought up, which in all of my experiences, it has been brought up or is brought up, then the people who are, it's like, I don't know if the proper term is cognitive dissonance, but it's like it doesn't agree with what I'm saying I'm doing, and therefore you're just bashing all gay people. And that's not true. I think a lot of Black people who are looking at the behavior are looking at it like, well, look, this isn't, it's very likely that you're doing this because of X, Y, and Z, and not because you think this is so-called natural to you, and having a little bit more information. And I just think that people don't want to hear that. And I can, and it's very interesting that, like, the conversation around rights, Black rights, then it's like women rights, and now it's like all this LGBTQQA, all this queer sexual fluidity rights. And it's so interesting because I wanted to comment on it on workplace racism when someone brought up like transgender, you know, having to do all of that. And we have extensive training on campus. The training is like 3 hours of like video and quizzing and all this kind of stuff. And it's about sexual violence, and I think that that's smart. But a lot of it is also on accepting, normalizing, protecting the whole gay, queer, everything. And I feel like this book is kind of like in that vein. And I wasn't there. I haven't read everything. But I don't think that so-called scene by the river or whatever with the white boy, like, nah, I don't know who wrote that and who said that, but I'm just going to reject that. I don't know. And I find, like, I didn't even realize that there was all this push for all of the, because I can see the trend. If they're doing it with Nat Turner, and I've heard about it with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and I've heard about it with Malcolm X, there's always some desire to make these men gay. And I disagree with the whole thing. I'll stop there, and if there's time, maybe later I'll comment. Thank you.
Right on. Any other commentary folks wanted to get in on the second audio segment, The Delectable Negro? Folks satisfied? I'll get in some of my observations, and then if we should have time, we should have about 10 minutes or so if folks have anything else that they would like to share. For number one, it seemed like there was like a massive deviation. I said from the very beginning of this chapter, the fact that
so much of this chapter, which is about Nat Turner, is focused on a book where a white liar presented historically inaccurate information about Mr. Turner. That's number one. That's taking up the bulk of it. And then black people's correct response to that, and even chastising how they responded. And then the second portion that started with a slave kiss from there forward, most of it doesn't even seem to be directly related to Nat Turner. I'm not at my best today. I'm still suffering through Pacific Northwest winter, a little grumpy. But I don't think even if I had been in like Hawaii today and had 80 degree weather and lots of sunshine to make my melanin happy, I don't think I would have been able to make a connect as to Nat Turner. It seemed like he totally disappeared, and it was focused on James Baldwin. And I don't have any beef with him. I read No Name in the Street. I have read quite a bit of James Baldwin's material, but it seemed focused on Baldwin as a quote unquote homosexual black male. And him being effeminized or thought of as not being a proper representative for black people or being closer to whiteness because of his sexual activity being quote unquote homosexual, it seemed like a major deviation to that and not being remotely about the consumption of Nat Turner in the section portion of the book. Maybe I was wrong. Folks can check me if, you know, I'm on here talking wild. The second section, specific notes that I took, in my view, if we're going to center a text where I have to continue to say, well, this person said some things that were not true. And this white person I'm reading now, Styron, failed on many historical accounts. Where I have to keep saying like this, it's just I cannot understand why this would be a central focus of what we're going to talk about. And if it's going to be, well, even though there were many historic failures on many historical accounts, and even though it was inaccurate, and you have to keep making all these qualifications, but he did present some quality material on homoerotic behavior. I just feel like there's a lot of compromising for an agenda, an LGBT gay rights agenda, which I just think is another division of the more refined white supremacy army. Continuing. And again, these sentences just keep popping up. Styron exploited this theme, and it's this homoerotic theme. This is right after the scene where they're talking about in Confessions of Nat Turner, Willis and Nat Turner, where they, I guess, are masturbating one another or whatever they're engaged in. These are two black slaves, where says he, and this is what its own words, where he admits he exploited this thing. That again, if we're talking about some white person who is lying and deliberately misrepresenting information for whatever the objective is, that's the thing, that's the story, not trying to dig around that and sift through it to get to some other agenda. Let's see. And I felt, for me, I juxtapose where it seems that there's a lot of making space and giving William Styron the benefit of the doubt and even finding some quality things about his lying work, that, and then the way that he talks about black people, where it's black people are not able to accept, black males specifically are not able to accept the horrors of cannibalism and male rape that happened during slavery. And he says black people's knee-jerk response to the Willis Turner scene, and let me make sure I get the whole sentence. Dubois more explicitly coupled his idea of something heathen in the folk with homosexuality and sexual abandon in his artistic culture of the Harlem Renaissance. Such evidence at least hints at something much deeper than the offense-taking that characterizes black people's knee-jerk response to the Willis Turner scene in Styron's novel. For one, I'm sure a lot of people, not just black people, had a quote-unquote knee-jerk response, being surprised or stunned or offended or whatever it was, just because that sort of graphic depiction, I think even now, would be stunning to a myriad of audiences. But just in my view, this is a larger theme of contempt for black people because they are not willing to accept or acknowledge homosexual behavior or homoerotic behavior. Continuing. I thought the scene where he talks about James Baldwin, this prominent white guy who grabs his penis, where he says that this was the guy I'm reading, where he says this white man was one of the men you called or had a friend call in order to get your brother off the prison farm. A phone call from him might prevent your brother from being dug up later during some random archaeological expedition. I don't know if people remember, there was a judge, I can get the exact article because this was recent, there was a white judge, and it was found out that he had all these photographs that he was getting people who came into court, right? They were facing a charge, criminal charge, right? Possible jail time, prison time, that he was manipulating them. He was exploiting them. It was, okay, this is what we'll do. If you want me to go easy on you and give you a light sentence, you come to my house, maybe you take some nude photographs, maybe we engage in some sexual activity, it's whatever I want, homoerotic behavior if you prefer, and maybe I'll go easy on you with your sentence. This was recent that he had been doing this, and he just this just got found out. Extremely important that this is a major aspect of racism, white supremacy, where whites all the time, whether it's black males, black females, black children, black elderly, being forced to submit to some sort of rape and sexual tyranny. If you don't do it, you're not going to get this job. If you don't do it, I'm going to put you in jail. If you don't do it, I'm going to lock you up. This is every day. If you don't do it, I'm going to fail you. This is every day, all day long, under the system of white supremacy. I thought that was really important point. Let's see. I thought it was really important. I'm going a little bit out of order, but there were two different occasions in this section where Woodard or the editors or whomever is responsible for putting this collection together, that we're reading The Delectable Negro, where they just made blanket indictments of black men. Black males, they said men in the book, black males, and saying that black males have these homophobic notions and they're just really not accepting, and this widespread notion where these indictments were made of black males in general, and both times the source where they were citing was Eldridge Cleaver from Soul on Ice. And in my view, that is like astronomically incorrect. Again, the way I would phrase it, that's what I would expect racists to do. Where Eldridge Cleaver, member of the Black Panther Party, he wrote Soul on Ice, and that's where some of the material at least came from, the book Soul on Ice. I think most black people would staunchly reject the idea that Eldridge Cleaver is representative of black males in general, even representative of black males' thoughts, feelings, views from the 1960s. I think most black people would say that that is highly incorrect. To put that out as some sort of legitimate opinion, and he does it, whomever is responsible for putting this collection together. It's done twice. I wrote down both of the different, for at least two different times. It might be more than that. I wrote down the specific footnotes where this happens. Nab both of those right now, in fact. Let's see. The first war, one of them, it's on page 196, where he says, within 1960s radical culture, black men applied the same paradigm of the virgin whore to black lesbians, black women who coupled with white men, and black women who asserted themselves in myriad ways, refusing domination by black men. Included in that is the, homophobic notions, not accepting homosexual behavior in black people. The citing is Eldridge Cleaver. He doesn't list anybody else. He goes on to talk about Eldridge Cleaver here, but there's nobody else cited who has these views. I reject that. In my view, it's just, there seems to be a pattern, and I would say especially so in this chapter, chapter 5 of this text, of just being extremely critical of black males who are not accepting of homosexual behavior or seem like they have a problem with it, or are just presenting in some sort of way where they are not willing to say, well, yes, there could have been homosexual black males during slavery, or homosexual homoerotic behavior during slavery or during other time periods, and that's okay, and whatever, just really going, in my view, after black males. So we've totally dropped Nat Turner, and even more aggressive than the way that Styron is critiqued in this portion of the book. Anything else I want to make sure I get in? I thought the section where he talks about how white people would read Uncle Tom's Cabin and other narratives talking about the enslavement of black people, and that was like pornography for them, where they became sexually aroused. Extremely important, and I think that sort of that behavior whites becoming aroused at the notion of, oh, I can own this nigger. I can tell them what to do. I can sell the officer. I can do whatever I want to them. And that being an aphrodisiac for racists, I think that is 2017. I suspect that could motivate a lot of individuals like Daniel Holtzclaw, convicted rapist, to become police officers in the first place. I also think that the same thing would apply when they read modern examples, whether it's The Help, whether it's Hidden Figures, which is pretty similar in my opinion, even modern depictions, Django Unchained, the Roots reboot that just came out last summer, 12 Years a Slave, any other of these depictions, maybe even Nate Parker's film. I suspect that the same applies, that white people go and they see works like this, that's why you end up with a winning phrase like "Make America Great Again." Anything else I want to make sure? I took a lot of notes, but I did not. This was not a pleasurable section to read. I thought it was really important. This is on page 195, where he's talking about Styron's novel, and he says that black people protested efforts in Hollywood to make Styron's novel a film. I said pretty emphatically last time that, in my view, there's no way I would say that Styron had no idea that this book was going to be really important or successful. He won all these awards. If whites in Hollywood were having a conversation about making this a film, I'm real sure. In fact, that alone to me would be enough to strongly suggest that there was probably an intense planning session, as they call it, a think tank about this book, how it's going to be marketed, what we're going to do, we're going to have a film attached to it, what awards, everything that I said before. So just to me, racists, they have long-term plans, 500-year plans about what they're going to do to maintain racism, white supremacy. This book and some of the concepts in it could be a part of that plan. Anything else I want to get in, and then we should have a little bit of time left if folks have any additional comments or if I've been talking wild. Let's see. I think I can rest there. If anybody else has any other commentary that they want to make sure that they get in, feel free. We still have about 5 minutes left. Folks, satisfied? Anything else they want to get in? I'll assume folks are satisfied. I did think also the section where James Baldwin, where he writes, this is on 193, where he says in his essay "Down at the Cross," a letter from a region in my mind, Baldwin refers to whites and blacks as having to come together as lovers in order to achieve America's loftiest ideals and transcend the prison of racial ideology. I've talked about this before. This is a long-running thing, this idea of black people and white people hook up or become lovers or date or marry or whatever it is, that will end the problem of racism. Again, and VGQ, Baldwin is a victim, but that idea, that concept is very popular. Nothing could be further from the truth. If anything, it shows the power of white supremacy that you still hear that idea now. In fact, there was just an article, and I think it was in the New York Times. It's like a major publication where they said the problem is that we don't have enough depictions of interracial lovers on television, that is somehow going to end the problem of racism. If that were true, this would have been done. This problem, white supremacy, would have been taken care of back in Thomas Jefferson's day. Obviously, that is false. It is nonsense, and it's dangerous because, unfortunately, many, many non-white people, not just black people, believe that that is true and devote themselves directly, indirectly, consciously, subconsciously to pursuing that as the means of ending racism. Yes, sir.
I'm sorry for interjecting. I did have something to say. I didn't get to my mute button in time, but I did want to say I absolutely agree with you about the veering off of the discussion from Nat Turner to it becoming about James Baldwin and us just being taken on this whirlwind through this James Baldwin analysis. And I thought of that as well, so I'm really glad that you brought it out as explicitly as you did. And again, I agree with just about every assessment you made, brilliant commentary. And there was a section I wanted to touch on from page 195 at the bottom. It says, "Needless to say, black men perceive Baldwin's speech and actions across a great divide. While he envisioned a new radical genealogy and pushed through Styron, for a model of antebellum resistance that included homoeroticism, most black men were still stuck on homosexuality as a derivative of white decadence and as sexual exploitation of black people. And I found that very interesting, simply because, again, they're stuck on styrene, and that somehow in order for antebellum resistance to be considered authentic, it had to leave room for some homoeroticism to be included. I just find that, again, disgusting, and again, trying to normalize homosexuality as this thing that was just an inherent part of Black American culture, and it's something that we should include in just about every aspect of our revolutionary resistance, which is just patently false. And then the other aspect that I found interesting was that Black men were still stuck on homosexuality as a derivative of white decadence and as a social exploitation of Black people. The whole idea of the homosexual rape of Black men was white decadence. But just like you just said, it's the whole idea, I could own this nigga. Not only own him, but I can rape him when I feel like it. I can indoctrinate him into homosexuality, and then also he'll self-perpetuate. Just like earlier in the text, when we, in the beginning, very first readings of the text, when they went over the life of Olaudah Equiano, the kidnapped prince from Nigeria, and how he was homosexualized and terrorized and raped. And then it got to the point where he associated full humanity with being white. And then he started to practice what was done to him on other non-white people that he came across. And just the wholesale rape of Black men was a part of white decadence. And it absolutely was about the sexual exploitation of Black people. And what we're seeing today is the epidemic expression of exactly that. Thank you. And I'll mute my line.
For sure. For sure. As I said, we are wrapping up the book. I think we might have two sessions left. We pretty much did almost the full chapter 5 today. We missed a couple pages, but we'll wrap that next week. And like I said, I think we two of these left, max 3. But we are very, very close to wrapping this one up. We'll be here tomorrow for the compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Dial in if you have thoughts, observations you'd like to share on what has transpired over the last 7 days, or just thoughts and observations about racism, counter-racism in general. Thanks to everyone who tuned into the broadcast. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Friday evening. If you have thoughts that you want to share on the book before we wrap up, you can email them in and we will read them as we progress through the text. I think we have 2 weeks left, so you don't want to sit on those too long. Go ahead and email them. We'll try and get them over the next couple of weeks. Email untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com. I know it is getting warmer, so for folks, particularly if you are in the southern part of the U.S., Southern California, wherever else you happen to be at, if you're going out, enjoying being outside a bit more, it's the weekend, you still want to be codified. Part of that code should be sobriety is always best under conditions of white supremacy. The evidence has shown we do not function better inebriated, whether it's alcohol, tobacco, cannabis, whatever it is, dealing with neutralizing the threat of racist man, racist woman, racist child. Dr. Welsing would encourage us to be sober. I think we might even do a better job recognizing some of the incorrectness of all this sexual activity if we are sober when we take a look, take some time to think about all of this. Just a suggestion. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.